order. We recessed yesterday afternoon, so we're back again. We left off with Ms. Jean Thorne, who was going to present, and we were going to give her an opportunity to do her presentation, hopefully without interruption, and if members would keep their questions to themselves or write them down, we'll have an opportunity to see any questions. So, Jean?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the record. Jean Thorne, currently the governor's office, but soon to be back as interim administrator of OMAP. And with me is Lynn Reed, assistant administrator of OMAP. And Lynn will be here to correct me or nudge me if I say something wrong, since I've been away from this for a while. I'm going to step back a moment. Yesterday, Mr. Chair, you mentioned about historical perspective since I was there in the past and left in 1995 and kind of the historical perspective of where we were, where we thought we were going, and where we are going or think we are going with the health plan. And I have already started talking a little bit about the waivers we've requested for what we call OHP2. But I was thinking it might be helpful just to go back and take a few minutes, brief minutes, to remind us of what we had hoped to do in the health plan, what has happened since then, and then why we're moving to the to OHP2 to try to provide some of that historical perspective. Back when we began the discussions around this in 1987-1988, really the concept of the Oregon Health Plan was to try to provide some kind of health care policy for the state. We really did not have a health, well, we don't have a health care policy nationally, I have to say. And it was clear that, as we discussed, and there were interim committees, I remember, between in 1988, looking at these issues of health care access, who was covered, who wasn't covered. And it was clear that what we had is that some of the poorest of the poor who fit in certain categories had a pretty good package of benefits through the Medicaid program, that you had those who were over 65, regardless of what their income was, who had a federally paid for Medicare package. You had those who had employer-sponsored coverage who, in most cases, had pretty good coverage. But we also had 400,000 people in the middle, those who were not the poorest of the poor, who didn't fit certain categories, who had nothing. And as those people, and so the issue is, how are those people getting their health care, and what was the effect of that? And what we saw, I think the term cost shift was probably a new term for many people. When those 400,000 people, most of whom were under 200% or so in federal poverty level, when their conditions became extreme enough, they showed up to hospital emergency rooms. They got expensive care. If they couldn't pay for that care, which in most cases they couldn't or couldn't pay all of it, somebody else paid for that care. Costs were shifted to everyone else who was paying. So as private employers had coverage, they saw they were paying for the cost of those 400,000 insured. As those costs escalated, premiums increased, employers said we can't afford coverage for as many people anymore, and would begin decreasing coverage or actually eliminating coverage, thus throwing more people back into the uninsured, and we had a real cycle there. So we had issues of a whole group of people with no coverage, and the costs were expensive when they were treated, in many cases were shifted to other payers. And so when we originally put the Oregon Health Plan together, there were a number of smaller components, but there were two primary components. One was that government should be responsible for taking care of the poor, regardless of whether they fit into a certain category. But if you are poor, if you're under poverty, government should be responsible for that. And we should provide benefits in a way where we stretched our public dollars on those services that do the greatest good. That the second component, which was actually the largest component, was that employers should be responsible for providing coverage for those who are employed. And it was put together as a pay or play, that either you provided coverage or you would pay in to some kind of pool coverage that would be provided. So a number of things have occurred. Those concepts were discussed beginning in 87, 88, passed in 1989. By the time we got our waivers on the Medicaid side, it was 1993, and Mr. Chair, as you noted, we spent a good deal of time in this very room during the 1993 session discussing funding for what then had become the Oregon Health Plan, the Medicaid component. And we began implementation in February of 1994. So what's happened since then? of the largest component, the employer mandate, went away. That was through a series of laws in 93 and then 95, an inability to get federal relief to allow us to do that. That part has never happened. So the focus has been on the government side of the Oregon Health Plan. When we look at the percentage of uninsured, in 1992, before we implemented the Oregon Health Plan, 18% of people in Oregon were uninsured. By 1996, that had dropped to 10.7%. That's been creeping up, back up since then, and over 12% again, over 400,000 again, uninsured. We've had a growing population. The actual dollar amount of hospital charity care, meaning the amount that was cost shifted, between 1993, prior to the health plan, and 1999, which people ask you, I happen to have data on, has actually gone down 24%. The amount has gone down 24%. At the same time, as gross patient revenues for hospital care have increased by 53%. So we have much more money being spent on hospital care in Oregon, generally, but the actual amount of charity care that's shifted has decreased. We've put in a number of controls in the Oregon Health Plan since it started in 1994. In 1996, we instituted premiums for that group of clients who were only eligible because of the waivers, about 100,000 people then and now who are on the Oregon Health Plan only because of the waivers. The other 350,000 or so, they're Medicaid eligible. We would be covering them anyway. But we instituted premiums in 1996. We moved from having no asset cap for eligibility, meaning you could have however much in the bank, to allowing only a $5,000 asset cap, only $5,000 in assets, to now only allowing $2,000 in assets. We did reduce list of coverage on the list. We reduced from the time we began by a total of 28 lines. We requested the federal government for more, two more, 10 more, I believe it is, didn't receive it. But we have done some reduction in benefits since that time. During the 2001 session, there were a number of other actions taken. Co-pays were approved. Some, I think, have been implemented. Some are going to be implemented yet on prescription drugs and ambulatory services. Reduced pharmacy dispensing and ingredient reimbursement. And as you know, in the process of implementing a preferred drug list. Mr. Chair, I smiled when you said, when I left home and everything was fine. And it caused me, when I took a look at the chart that was given to you by John Britton the other day, of the number of eligibles that are currently projected to be in the Oregon Health Plan, and I turned with that through, I thought, I think I may have some data about when I left in September of 1995, and I did. I found a chart. And I just wanted to do a little comparison. In September of 1995, we have the total number of people in medical assistance programs, so all of the Oregon Health Plan, Medicaid, as well, about 400,000 people. And of the 400,000 people, about 130,000 were eligible only because of the health plan, what we've been calling new eligibles or adults and couples. So they were the people that were added to Medicaid because of the Oregon Health Plan waivers. About 400,000, 130,000 of whom were these people only eligible because of our waivers. In the sheet that John Britton provided to you the other day of our April 2002 rebound, we are now at a total of 450,000, and of those, 110,000 are eligible only because of the health plan. So we've grown totally by 50,000. We've actually reduced the number who are only eligible because of the health plan, current health plan waivers, by 20,000. So if we look over several years, and I know if we look at growth over the last 2 or 3 years, what you'll see is that the caseload growth has really occurred in the other parts of the program that don't have a relationship to the waivers that we have in place now. One of the things that did occur while I was gone was the institution of the CHIP program for uninsured children. So of that 50,000 growth in caseload, 20,000 are uninsured children who the legislature has chosen to cover. So the caseload growth really has been in these other programs, and the programs that would be there anyway, regardless of the current waiver in place. We've had some level of benefit decreases, as I noted. So when we look at the cost increases, the issue primarily is one of medical inflation and medical utilization. It's the same kind of issues we're trying to address that the private sector is trying to address as they're doing with health care benefits. As I noted yesterday, the health plan, Oregon Health Plan, doesn't drive health care costs. The Oregon Health Plan tries to respond to them, just like the private sector is trying to respond to health care costs. They're going up. You see it every day. I think there's something in the paper again today. How do we respond to that? As we have these increasing costs, that group in the middle, those without insurance, again, has begun to grow. And I think as Senator Ferrioli noted yesterday, you have people having to make a choice of whether or not they take a job or additional hours and lose coverage under the Oregon Health Plan or not. We have a cliff. So those who are eligible, again, only because they have the health plan, that cliff is at 100% of poverty. You make a dollar over, you're out of luck. You go into the ranks of the uninsured. So as we look at the cost, and we go back to, again, one of the original premises of the health plan, which was we will reduce benefits. That was we would control costs by moving the line. As I noted, we did that some. We moved along 28 lines. But clearly, the federal government, and I think others as well, do have problems with decreasing benefits further or much further to people who are traditionally eligible for Medicaid. The elderly, the disabled, children, poor families who qualify for TANF. These are people who have been deemed federally as being more medically vulnerable. And so I think what we found is that the prioritized list of health care services, although it serves a purpose, it's not one size fits all. That those who are eligible, the adults, 100,000 or so adults who have coverage only because of the health plan, may have different situations medically, probably do have different situations medically than others who are categorically eligible for Medicaid. And not only do they anyway, but in the eyes of the federal government, they likely will. So the approach then with OHP2, and as we look at House Bill 2519, was that for those who are only eligible because of our current waivers, 110,000 we're at now, who are adults, they're not classified as elderly or disabled, we should look at trying to institute a different benefit package, one that more closely resembles what the private sector has, and using the kinds of controls the private sector is trying to use right now in doing the self-care process. And at the same time, in the absence of other efforts or private sector ability to cover more of those people in the middle, we should try to see, is there a way to stretch the dollars we do have to cover more of those low-income people who are falling in the middle whose costs are being shifted so that we can at least address in some way those costs that are shifted and that are in turn driving the private sector health care costs that are seen. So that really is a large systemic issue that we're trying to deal with. So House Bill 2519 then called for establishing two different benefit packages within the traditional Medicaid program. OHP Plus for those who are deemed the more medically vulnerable, those who would be traditionally eligible for Medicaid and for the CHIP program. And then OHP Standard, those who are only eligible because of our current waivers, the adults under the poverty level. That we should have some level of expansion in the public sector program, primarily for pregnant women and children, but also some expansion in the public sector program for other adults. And that we should expand the current state effort to subsidize private sector coverage through the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program. And as you see, as I go through, I gave you three charts yesterday, I'll want to turn to in a moment, almost all the expansion that we have planned isn't in the public sector program, it's in the FEOC program, which subsidizes private sector coverage. With that, what I'd like to do there, I gave you three charts yesterday, and the one that is these three bars, you can't read very well, says attachment A, and as I noted yesterday, this hasn't been updated for our current caseload estimates, but just to graphically give you an idea, and this is looking at percentage of the federal poverty level. And the parts that are in white is what we currently do, and the parts that are shaded would be expansions of coverage. And let me just go through them briefly. The left-hand side, those who are in OHP Plus, or will be in OHP Plus, are those who would be otherwise categorically eligible. Canada, elderly, disabled, pregnant women and children eligible for the poverty level program or the CHIP program. And as you can see, we would expand coverage from 170 to 185% of poverty. And when we get further into another chart, it's not really very many people. But there's some expansion there. And since we are asking the federal government through these waivers to use all of our available CHIP money, we need to be able to show some expansion to children, since that's really supposed to be focused on uninsured children. The group in the middle is what will be called OHP standards. And so currently, and all of these people are in one package now, but it's the adults with children, the childless couple, adults with children who would not be able to shop for TANF, and childless couples, or single people. Currently, we cover to 100% of poverty. We are asking for approval, and I'll get in, as I get into this a little bit, at this point, it's a very much a staged expansion. Potentially, we've asked for federal approval to go to 185% of poverty, subject to funds available. I'll talk to you about that, because we have asked for authority to cap enrollment. So it's not opening the door to everybody. Yet we will only take as many as we can afford. And as we get into state registration, we'll talk about that as well. The FEOP program, which is currently state-funded only, we are asked and goes to 170% of poverty. I think that the numbers that are here are way off at this point. I think we're under 4,000 who are currently in the program. But the waiting list is over 20,000 people who have applied to that program. This provides subsidies for private sector coverage, in most cases on the individual market, currently in the program. I think it's 90-10, about 90% is individual, maybe a little different by now, 10% group market. What we're asking for is the ability to claim federal match on that program and to grow that program, both in terms of numbers and to expand eligibility from 170 to 185% of poverty, but again with the ability to cap enrollment. We will only go as far as state dollars will allow us to do. Now, how do we get those state dollars? If you look at this one here, it's the initial OHP standard benefit package. What we are doing is saying for those people who are only or have only been eligible for the health plan because of our waivers, they are adults and not classified as elderly or disabled, we want to go to benefit package that looks more like the private sector. And what's the private sector doing? They're doing copay. And they're increasing copay, as you know, and as probably all of us are experiencing in our health care coverage. The initial package that has been approved went through the Health Services Commission, the Waiver Application Steering Committee worked with that. It then went to the Emergency Board. What we've asked for is the ability, tell you about what we've asked the federal government for, but the initial OHP standard benefit package would have these services with these kinds of copays on them. They would be mandatory copays. And so if a person shows up at the physician's office and they can't pay their $5 copay for the office visit, the physician would have the authority to say, I'm not going to serve you. They don't have that in regular Medicaid programs. They can't turn down someone because of inability to pay. And I think, you know, there's a question, and I think physicians will tell you, in some cases, they're going to serve someone anyway. But many physicians will also say they want this tool for people who come in and come in and come in who don't need to come in. This is overlaid on top of this is the prioritized list of health services. So those physician treatment payers that are below the line 566 will also not be covered for this group. So if it's a hospital service for a condition that wouldn't be covered anyway, it's not going to be covered here. If it would be covered, it'll be covered, but they'll have to pay $250 per admission. So we have co-pays in here. What's not covered at all that would be covered for the OHP plus population, vision care, non-emergency transportation. The dental package is about half of what the elderly and the disabled and the TANF clients would have. So the dental package is much less than would be available to the OHP plus population. There are a whole set of co-pays, and Senator Fisher, to respond to your question yesterday on dental co-pays, you actually have that in your packet. It's under the waiver tab, Appendix 3.1, it's about three or four pages of the co-pays. But the $500 benefit limit for each 6 months. Well, if they need something and they're over the $500 benefit limit, it will not be covered. The durable medical equipment package is much less than the current package. So there's no coverage for one-time durable medical equipment, wheelchair, crutches, those kinds of things. So it supplies oxygen supplies, those types of diabetic supplies. Now, the Health Bill 2519 called for the Health Services Commission to develop a priority. This is a separate prioritized list than the regular list is 700 and some lines of condition treatment criteria. Said to start with the actuarial equivalent of Medicaid-mandated services. Medicaid-mandated services are the first six categories listed here: inpatient, outpatient, emergency room, physician, lab, nursery, and ambulance. That is at about, currently, been at about 58% of the benefit package, the current OHP plus benefit package, when they were asked to build from there. And so the other services below that, prescription drugs, this is in priority order, prescription drugs, mental health, durable medical, dental, are all optional services from the government. They're optional. And so what we asked the federal government for, because of the problems we've had, we're getting approval from them in the past on the prioritized list, we wanted to have the ability to go to that floor, the actuarial equivalent, without getting prior approval from them. As you may know, sometimes when we've asked for approval in the past on the other list, it's gone on for months and months and months before we ever get an answer, if we do. We are saying we want more flexibility than that. As I noted yesterday, we don't have the waiver in our hands yet. We expect to have it within the next week or so. But we've finalized negotiations, and I'm almost ready to tell you this because I'm concerned if there are, because there are some who are definitely concerned with the flexibility. They don't want us to have the flexibility we're asking for. But the federal government did not like the actuarial equivalent piece. And so what we agreed to is that we would cover mandated services, not to exceed the cost sharing that's in here and overlaid by the prioritized list. So in essence, if you look down through ambulance, we've agreed that we won't go below these services and that we would not increase co-pays for those services beyond what we have. It's actually, that package is less than the actuarial equivalent. It actually gets you down to 53%. One of the concerns, I think the federal government felt more comfortable with that because one of the states came in and said, well, we'll provide benefits, but we're not going to do any hospital coverage. Actually, they gave approval to that state to do that. And federal government's been under a lot of pressure from Congress because they get granted that approval. So we said, no, we will provide those mandated benefits. So at this point, given where we left negotiations with the federal government, we will have the authority. We could go all the way from dental down to ambulance and take those services away without getting prior approval from them. Now, I want to put that in perspective, though, because as you look at these categories, the first category you would take away would be dental coverage. Now, dental coverage is less than 5% of the cost of the school or of the larger coverage. So that would get you some, a good chunk of change. what's left of durable medical equipment is less than 0.5%. So you could cut that. You wouldn't get much savings. The next two categories, mental health and clinical dependency and prescription drugs, are big dollars. Mental health and chemical dependency is over 8% of the benefit package. Again, it's a larger benefit package. Prescription drugs is almost 20%. Now, yes, we technically could eliminate those services. I would say that there are a couple of concerns. You eliminate mental health and chemical dependency services, those people are going to show up in the ER, they're going to show up in physician's offices. So the cost of those other mandated services will go up. Prescription drugs is the same thing. If people can't access some basic prescription drugs, they likely will end up in the physician's office, in the hospital, getting care for the mandated services. So although technically we would be able to eliminate those services without federal approval, I think we'd be seeing cost increases elsewhere. I think also there would be a big concern for the managed care plans, especially around prescription drug coverage, if we say we're not going to cover that anymore, because they are then the ones assuming the risk of the hospital coverage, the physician coverage.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Farrell.
Have we suggested that the director finish your testimony before the question? Thank you.
This is a big area of flexibility that we're going to have for over 100,000 clients who are currently on the Oregon Health Plan, that we can make these reductions in coverage without prior approval from the federal government. Again, we don't have the waiver in hand. I'm a little concerned if they think we are going to go all the way down to the mandated services, whether we would get that. And so I just caution that. But it does appear we'll have that flexibility. What we will have less flexibility on, which is interesting in our negotiations, is to change cost sharing. And so we could eliminate dental or eliminate durable medical equipment, but if we want it without their prior approval, but if we want to change the co-pays, we have to go back to them for approval. Apparently, they have more limited abilities to bring up waivers in that area. And unfortunately, the way this is kind of the one big sticking point that we had, that was the only real thing left in the negotiations. Because it would be a waiver amendment, there's no set timeline that they would have to get back to us. So cost sharing, changes in cost sharing, we have less flexibility, or changes in premiums, we have less flexibility on. One point that I was asked to make at John Britton, apparently the first day, John was asked whether the legislature needed to have a bill to move the line. And I believe he responded this was legislature wouldn't. We talked about that yesterday. The legislature would not need a bill to move the line on the list if it's within the current appropriation. If it's a management action to stay within whatever is appropriated, the legislature, emergency order or legislature, could direct us to move that line. If, however, it would be an actual disappropriation, then the legislature would have to have the bill to do that. So we will have more flexibility, a lot more flexibility, for about 100,000 of people who are currently on the health plan. The last chart I wanted to walk you through, and this is where I'm especially going to ask Lynn for help, since she's the budget person at OMAP, if I get into trouble here. It says Oregon Health Plan 2, State Budget Neutrality, May 24th. And what I want to show you here are the savings that we will be able, that even under the current plan, without even going any further than what we have here on this benefit package, what kind of savings we expect under OHP 2, and then what the cost would be of the expansion. And it needs to be noted, I mentioned it yesterday, that the federal government is not going to allow us flexibility to just reduce benefits without any kind of expansion. What we've shown them is we will take every last dollar and we have savings and we will put this into expansion. Now, could the expansion be slightly less? Could it be not quite as quickly as we had anticipated? I believe we will be able to do that. And the federal government knows that we may not bring the program up as quickly as we had planned. They've given us the ability to cap enrollment. We said we will cap enrollment to stay within available state dollars and make it state budget neutral. They've given us, or they're poised to give us, that flexibility. It's a little unclear until we get the final document from them whether we have to get approval before we open or close enrollment. We can phase in enrollment, which is actually the plan we put forward to them based on the emergency board direction. So let me walk you through this so you get a sense of the savings we're looking at and how the savings will be used. The first box is the savings, and you can see both 0103 and then we put in 0305. The 0103.
Hey, Jean, we're a little confused about which.
Okay. Look at light. Okay.
Yeah, that's it.
I can't see that part. But I'm using my contact lens. So, we've shown what we would expect for the rest of 0103. Assuming the phase in we assumed in May, which may need to be altered some, given that we don't have the waiver in hand yet, but then showed 0305, 24 months, so you could take a look at that. Now, this assumes we actually asked the federal government for approval to start October 1, and as you see as I walk through here, I'll talk about it. We think we could begin the FEOP part October 1, although we're getting awfully close now, or at least we can begin cutting federal match on FEOP beginning October 1. The savings piece, because it requires a lot of systems work to have a separate benefit package with copay, systems work on the part of DHS, on the part of managed care plan, we are shooting for December 1. That may be very tough. We've got to make a decision here in the next probably 2 weeks whether or not we're going to be able to make that, especially since we don't have the waivers in, although we think we know what we're going to be allowed to do. So each month we delay being able to institute the new benefit package, the savings will be somewhat less in 0103. But if we began December 1, the savings, because we would immediately go from the current benefit package down to 78% of the current benefit package for those 110,000 people who are currently on the health plan, we get almost $20 million in general fund savings this biennium. If you take it to a 24-month period, we currently have 110,000. When we look at 0305, we're projecting, and this is again was back in May, we're projecting 126,000 who would be in that category. We get about $80 million in general fund savings. The FEOP program currently is all state funds. The federal government, we had to do a complicated waiver process because one waiver, type of waiver they give you, you can't claim match on a current state-funded program. And so we did another waiver in combination with that type of waiver. But again, we have to show expansion. And we will have a state maintenance adjustment, so we can't spend less than this in the FEOC program than the current state maintenance, which I think is about $20 million. But by being able to claim federal match on the current FEOC program, there's about $5 million in general fund savings this biennium, which then going over a 24-month period, you've got close to $14 million in general fund. One of the other things that we're doing, and it appears they're giving us approval to do, is on premium side for those, again, the 110,000 who are currently in, plus any additional expansion we do in the public for the standard population. We will be increasing premiums from the levels we currently have. And we will be much, much tougher in how we handle those premiums. When we instituted premiums in 96, the federal government made us put in a number of exceptions, and you heard a little bit of that yesterday on the eligibility audit. Those without income, we couldn't charge premiums, or they reported zero income. We won't have that waiver anymore. If you're in this program, you're going to be required to pay your premium. Now, the other thing is the federal government had us do when we originally put this in is you had to keep people on for 6 months, their 6 month period of eligibility, even if they didn't pay their premium. At that point, they had to pay up before they could become eligible again. It's the 6 month disenrollment. People will be given notice, and sufficient notice. And if they don't pay, they will go off the program. So we anticipate, we've had about a 72% collection rate. We anticipate about a 95% collection rate. We don't know how, that's our best estimate, and higher premiums. So from that, we will have that $3 million of savings this biennium going to $25 million of savings next biennium. The other thing I should note is that on what will now become OHP standards, for those people coming into the program, we will have to show 6 months period of uninsurance. So if there are concerns that employers may be covering them and they drop their income slightly to qualify them, they'll have to be uninsured for 6 months before they can come on. So those are the types of savings that both the rest of this biennium, depending on when we can get the standard part up, and for a 24-month period. So now we look at then how would we spend those monies, assuming we don't spend any more state money than we would otherwise expect to spend. The first, it says VHS adult outreach. We would expect as we begin talking about a new program, there are a lot of people out there who are eligible for the Oregon, who could be eligible for the Oregon Health Plan right now. You don't know that. You start talking about changes, you bring in more people to the current firm without ever even changing eligibility. So we said we want to use some of those savings to pay for increased caseloads in what will now become OHP standards. So we would expect, and we don't know as I get through this, to see that our expansion on the public program versus the private program is pretty minimal. But we would expect that that might mean $10 million that we would have to spend this time on increased caseload. If you take it out to 0305, it goes up to $56 million, 22,500 more people. We don't know. It might be less than that. And I would think because we are, frankly, looking at a very limited expansion, it might be less than that. But we're, in essence, saying these are paying for people who could be eligible right now to be coming in. The next categories then relate to the actual expansion. As we expand the CHIP program for pregnant women and kids to from 170 to 185% of poverty, you'll see VHS, children expansion. We think next biennium that would be about 1,400 children. It's some expansion, but and for that group, because it's over on the plus side, it will be open if they come in and they have to, they only have to be uninsured under the CHIP program, but if they qualify, they qualify. On the adult expansion, the emergency, again, this is VHS adult expansion, the emergency board, when they approve the waiver, the wording in House Bill 2519 is going up to 185% of poverty subject to funds available. The emergency board was concerned with how are you really going to cap it, because we will have to cap enrollment to say we run out of money, we're closing the door for these over the poverty level. The EE board directed that we start the program only going to 110% of poverty, that we then come back and assess and on a quarterly basis, where are we? And at that point, the emergency board, legislature, the emergency board would decide, can we afford to go up, and they talk about 15% increment. Could we afford to go from 110% to 125%? So the plan at this point is, again, if we can bring the VHS part of this up in December, that we would open it for 3 months. We would close it, again, only to 110% of poverty. We'd see where we are, and if we can't afford at that point to go up higher, we will. But given the data that we have about who's out there who potentially might qualify, we don't see exposure of having it open for 3 months because we think there are less than fewer people out there than would use up the money that we have available. We'll have the ability to open and close the program in that manner. As you can see, as we move into 0305, we would expect then that close to 12,000, maybe 12,000 people on top of the 126,000 who would normally have in the OHP standards who would qualify. Most of the expansion would occur in the FEOP program. The FEOP program, as I noted, subsidizes private sector coverage. The directive from the emergency board was that they wanted to see an additional 25,000 people in the FEOP program. And there's currently somewhere around 4,000 people in FEOP. The directive is in House Bill 2519, and with the emergency board then is to have most of that focus be on the employer-sponsored coverage side, on the group side. People come in today, if the program will open, and they have group coverage, and in many cases, the employer will pay for the employee's coverage, but doesn't subsidize the dependent. There will be a subsidy for the dependent coverage, again, depending on what income level. Standard and fiat, both more income, the less subsidy you get, the more you have to pay out in premium. Now, as I noted, most of the enrollment at FIOP is on the individual side. That's more expensive. And the more people who get concerned about insurers, if you open up the individual market and those people can't get coverage, they go into the medical insurance pool, and that's subsidized by assessments on insurers. Insurers don't want to have more subsidy. So 2519 directs that FIOP have a goal of splitting resources equally between the individual side and the group side. So initially, the plan is that there will be aggressive marketing on the group side. For those who, and we're not going to 110, we're going to 185 on the FIOP side. So if you're a person in a family with income at 180% of poverty and you have employer group coverage available, you can get a subsidy. Unfortunately, if you're a person at 111% of poverty, and there's no group coverage available, you won't get anything. That is a concern about, because if we have the public sector program down here and the group coverage program, private sector program 185, there are concerns there about whether or not, or concerns I think we have, about whether we're kind of dinging people twice. And not only do you not have group coverage available, but you can't get any subsidy for that. But most of the expansion will occur on the FIOP side. The plan is to do aggressive marketing. They can't do it yet until we have the waiver in place. Grow that quickly, and to then, once they've equalized those resources, to open the individual side as well. And so we'll have to open and close those sides depending on how much money is available. So the expansion then, and this is assuming you use the savings, you use all those savings, here's how the expansion is predicted to occur. There will be, and I think the e-board requires that there be quarterly reports, maybe even more frequently than that, to assure the legislative, I think the reports that are legislative fiscal, and we go to e-board quarterly. Where are we in terms of savings? Where are we in terms of caseload increase? Having the ability to cap enrollment for those over the poverty level is a very important component. You're not just opening the door. And now, the question would be, this is what we've told the federal government we're going to do in terms of expansion. Could we do an expansion that's less than that? I think we probably could. Could we do no expansion? No. The federal government would not, for me to give us the waiver, they would pull the waiver because of that. But I think even as we've looked at some of the budget issues for 0103, if we're able to implement the savings side of this more quickly on December, but the expansion on FIOP goes more slowly or on the standard side more slowly, you're capturing some one-time savings. Could we cap at lower levels than this in 0305? I think we probably could. But the question would be kind of what's the federal government's level of tolerance? So again, there we'll have some ability to achieve some savings or control costs that we don't have now. So that's the outline of how we would operate the program, why we're doing this. Again, looking at the big picture, I know there are a number of issues, and we're beginning into these issues for more today, on eligibility and some of the on. And those are always, as I noted, issues we can deal with. From here, we are really looking at a major restructuring of the Oregon Health Plan to allow us some ability, some tools that we don't currently have in place. The tools are the same tools the private sector is using right now as it is dealing with health care costs, and that is copay, looking at benefit changes, increased premiums. I think that the waivers we've requested and the peers we're going to receive will allow us more teeth in some of the things we have had. I will tell you that there are many concerns from the advocacy community that, yeah, we're talking about adults who are not as medically vulnerable, but these are poor adults. Many of those who are currently on the health plan would fit into this OHP standard category have incomes less than 10% of the federal poverty level. And so there are concerns about the impact of co-pays and premiums. As we developed this package for the waiver application steering committee, and Representative Cruz sat on there, as did Senator Fisher, you had groups on one side saying, you're going too far. You had groups on the other side saying, you're not going far enough. I think as we get into this whole issue of healthcare costs and what drives healthcare costs, there are many people with interests and there are many drivers. You push here and it pushes out someplace else. And so, yes, the Oregon Health Plan, the state is a big purchaser of healthcare. We don't control the healthcare market, however. And so I think the approach we're trying to take is one that allows us much more flexibility and tools than we've had in the past. The federal government, we've gotten, as I said, almost every piece of appears. We're receiving almost every bit of flexibility we had hoped. Having been there through negotiations in the original health plan, it's amazed me. But I think that the times are different, and I think that we do have some opportunities to better be able to, as we talked about on the first day, being able to sustain the money.
All right. And just let me go back in memory here and hope everybody understands and hope I'm correct. But the Oregon Health Plan, those persons who are currently receiving benefits under that plan, whether it's 110 or 120 or however many people it is, that is an optional program, correct?
For those 110, the federal government has mandatory people you cover, optional people you can cover, and this is a completely separate group that we only cover because they have waivers. They don't have, normally would have coverage in their federal government.
And I'm trying to put this in the context of the legislature mm-hmm. and some of the environment within which we find ourselves now with declining resources. So this group of individuals, as far as coverage is concerned, is an option. It can theoretically go away
mm-hmm.
if that is possible. Question of the wisdom of it, I'm not sure. But I mean, I think Senator Farrelly indicated that this is an important element of need in his community. The benefit of the existing Oregon Health Plan, I want to go back just briefly, and if you could explain to what have we benefited, and how can you, I guess, document the benefit of the Oregon Health Plan in terms of serving this population? Where have we seen an actual benefit?
I think, Mr. Chair, in a couple of places, and unfortunately, it doesn't especially translate to savings to state government. It translates to savings to everybody else. With the percentage of uninsured having gone down from 18% to 10.7%, as I said, going back up, the fewer people there are uninsured, the less caution there is.
But why is that the state's interest? And this is why I raised the issue. It seems to me that there's very little, what do you call it, uncompensated care being accomplished by hospitals anymore. And they used to do a lot of that stuff. People would walk in and they'd write it off as part of their business. That's why some of the hospitals clearly are nonprofit organizations. They have tax-exempt statuses and they had a mission of doing certain kinds of benefit work. So speaking, some physicians did likewise, had free clinics, et cetera. But I'm not sure that in creating the Oregon Health Plan as a matter of public policy, that what we've done is we begin to compensate people and institutions for work they were already doing. Now, that may be inherently good, but I'm not sure that it's really accomplished anything.
I think, Mr. Chair, I mean, hospitals would say that, yes, they are providing uncompensated care, and they're being compensated, but they're being compensated by other payers who have to pay more. So I think, I mean, in the state's interest, there are a couple of things. I'm not saying state government's interest especially, but in the state's interest, you're bringing health care coverage to 110,000 people who didn't have it before. Now, that in, for, you know, I mean, just from a humanitarian standpoint, I hope there's some interest there on that. But if those people don't have coverage, they do show up. I mean, just the fact that the charity care did decrease, didn't go away, the charity care decreased, it means that much less, and that's possible where we can capture that information. It's that much less cost that's being shifted to other payers. Well, I guess you could say state government, or state government purchases coverage for its employees as well.
So in essence, we're doing this because it's an inherent good or something that's humanitarian, so to speak.
Well, yeah. I think it's humanitarian, but I think it's also in the private sector, it's something of benefit to them because that would be something they'd have to be paying for otherwise to cost you. The other thing we're doing is by getting, again, if you think of these people having coverage versus not having coverage, that because we have coverage, and especially coverage from a managed care environment, they're getting preventive care and early intervention, and that's less costly than if they show up, because when they do show up at the emergency room, they're going to have these things of care.
Can we quantify those? Is that quantifiable?
We have Lemreed, assistant administrator with the Office of Medical Assistance Programs in the Department of Human Services. We haven't been able to quantify it in the sense of we've spent this amount of money, and we know that having provided the preventive care early intervention has resulted in not having to spend on the back end for higher cost, more significant intervention. We've looked at that issue. We haven't found a way to really do a cause and effect and quantify that.
So we make the statement up front that it's going to do X, but we can't quantify that X actually happened.
No, we've done some work in terms of identifying that we have done preventing early intervention.
Well, we know that, but this is the result that we're looking. We can't quantify that. Is what you're telling me.
That's correct.
And whatever efforts have been attempted to try to quantify that, we've been unsuccessful.
There have been some studies, and these need to be done by people who are more expert in this than our department would be, trying to do some quantification, for example, in the alcohol and drug abuse arena, that providing services, preventive services in that arena and treatment result in a long-term savings. And some of that work has been done.
I want to go back to a question that I think may have some legal ramifications, but I'm not sure if I throw these things out there. But the idea of capping expansion, what do we call it again?
OHP standard.
The OHP standard, okay. Where we're going to theoretically go up to 185%, but we're going to cap it based on available resources. Has there been analysis with respect to whether or not that cap is defensible? That once you say certain people in certain categories with certain incomes have a public benefit provided for by the state of Oregon in cooperation with the federal government, that in fact that the cap is enforceable, that we would not be sued where someone says, wait a minute, you have no basis.
Mr. Chair, from both the state perspective in terms of how House Bill 2519 was worded and the federal government allowing us to move this forward, it specifically is not an entitlement. It's subject to available funds, as House Bill 2519 says, and the federal government, so it would either be a state or a federal issue, and the federal government is allowing us to cap enrollment, and they've done that in other states as well.
So who do they get to sue if you're a person believed to be wrong? Would they sue the federal government, or would they sue us?
In this case, Mr. Chair, I mean, I guess we'll sue anyone, but I think it's defensible from both the state and federal government perspective. That's why the bill was written that way, and that's why we specifically asked the federal government for that.
Okay. And then one other thing for background, because I'm a little confused about this over the history of the Oregon Health, we have this line that goes up or down, or at least the discussion in the early days. And then if I recall a few years back, there was a move towards managed care, et cetera, et cetera. And I recall some discussions in committees where we were talking about the fact that we're actually paying certain provider groups or insurers to cover whatever. In other words, the line kind of went away.
Mr. Chair, the team, you've got your managed care and you've got fee for service. Okay. So if someone's fee for service, and they're provided something that isn't covered, something that's below line 566, that claim's rejected. They don't get, I mean, there's some little circumstances, comorbidity, you don't want to know that, but if that claim, you don't pay for that. The rates, the capitation rates that are paid to managed care plans assume they are providing services 1 through line 566.
Right, so we have
that's the basis for it. The actuary determines what it costs to deliver 1 through 566. Now, the managed care plan, again, I've been away for a few years, this is how it used to be. The managed care plan decides for an individual patient, they want to provide line 590 because it makes sense for that patient. They can do it, but we're not going to give them any more money. So the capitation rate is based on covering line 1 through 566.
You mentioned about the donated care and the so forth not having kept pace with the gross revenues, but you didn't do any kind of information to give us any kind of information on what has happened to payroll during that particular period of time, what has happened to cost of licensing, what has happened to the cost of equipment, supplies, all those things, and donated care or donated services are the first to suffer when bills have to be paid. And also, it takes no provision and makes no, allowance in your statement for the fact that very little of the Oregon Health Plan monies fully cover all the expenses. So there could be a good many reasons. It's not just because it's almost intimated in your statement that these people are getting tight and they're not doing all these good things and so forth, but it's an overall problem. It's not just quite that simple.
Mr. Chairman, two questions you raised there. When I talked about the actual amount of charity care going down while hospital gross patient revenues increased, what I'm saying is the savings aren't just that. I mean, the savings are actually, if it went down 24% while it goes up, that's something that I wasn't intimating.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm saying the hospital costs are going up, so we're capturing that. What we don't have data on, because we don't have, hospitals are required to file cost reports, so we can see that. We don't know how much uncompensated care there was or is for other tests, for physicians, for dental. We know what goes on out there, but we don't have any way to access that data. That was your first question. The second, in terms of keeping pace, when we instituted the Oregon Health Plan, one of the pieces was that the managed care would have rates to try to cover the cost, not for people to make, profits out, but to cover the cost of providing care. So when we started the health plan, the managed care rates, there was a significant bump at that point in what kind and how much was being paid to providers, knowing we were not paying providers well at all, and they were losing money every time they saw a Medicaid client. Now, since then, I've been gone for 7 years, but the increases that we've seen that have been allowed in the managed care contract is something the actuary has been able to defend as being able to represent the reasonable cost of doing business. Now, does it fully cost for any given, it may cover the cost for some and not for others. And so certainly there are concerns on the managed care, certainly on the patient service side, we've always underpaid here. But on managed care as well, there are concerns about are we paying enough? And just as you see, our premiums going up for your own private health insurance, that happened as well on this. And so it's an issue of are we paying enough? We may be for some, and there may be others that we're not paying enough. But it's the question of is enough an issue for the state, or is enough an issue for how are the plans dealing with blood costs?
Mr. Chair, yes, sir. Hirsch Crawford rather glibly testified in my Health and Human Services Committee that they were paying on a basis of about 65%. The cost estimating that the medical community was basically making 35% of their money. And I called them on that because we wouldn't have doctors working into their 60s if they were making 35% on their money and on their work. It's ridiculous. They're still losing money and having to cost shift, maybe not as much, and I agree with you, and that's one of the significant reasons I supported the Oregon Health Plan, because I felt that it did put some extra money into some of these programs, which badly needed it. But it still has eaten into their overall ability to do a lot of the things that they once did, probably in the charity arena, simply because of the increased usage. You don't make money by just going in the hole faster and treating more people.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to push right. I don't know the 65%, but I would.
That was his statement.
Some of the things that have changed besides the Oregon Health Plan in the last few years. Providers have just kind of four main sources of payers they work with: Medicaid, Medicare, private sector, and then self, and then those are the things. And a couple of things have happened, I think, especially physicians over the last couple of years. Well, let me first of all back up. To the degree there was some level of underpayment to a particular provider from Medicaid, the providers often had some room to absorb that, some level to absorb that, because of revenues that were coming in from other payers. What we've seen happen over the last few years, Medicare has ratcheted down. I think that's particularly true for physicians as well, and hospitals as well. They've ratcheted down on what they pay. The private sector payers are saying, we're putting the screws on as well in terms of, and so the ability of providers to maybe absorb some underpayment that they have from Medicaid before has been diminished, and that's a legitimate issue. Now, I think the issue always is, how much do we pay? How much, I mean, I'd love to be able to say we'll pay whatever they charge. We can't afford as a state to do that. And then there's the cost to charge, and the charges are going to be higher than the actual cost because they're trying to deal with these fluctuations in uncompensated care. So for a given provider, might they be getting less than their cost? They might not, from Medicaid, but their ability to be able to absorb if they are has been lessened over the last few years because the other payers are all also rationing down
the Medicaid. Mr. Chair, I wanted to get that on the record because it has been alluded in two or three of my committee meetings that because of the more, the higher payment that Oregon Health Plan provided, that the providers have taken advantage of that and are no longer doing the amount of charity work. And I just wanted well on the record that there's a lot of various factors that play into this and not just greediness on the part of providers.
Mr. Chair and Senator Fisher, I think the other thing that we're seeing now, certainly in the physician community, medical malpractice is going through the roof, and so their costs are higher than they were in the past. So there are a number of factors out there that drive the ability of a provider to be able to see organ health patients.
And Mr. Chair, I have one question. I've tried to search through this information that we were given, and I don't find it.
The dental copay?
The dental copay.
Yeah, there's a tab that says, I think it says waiver. And in the very back of the waiver document, or towards the back, there's Appendix 3.1. I don't have it with me. I think it's like page 60 or something. There's about three pages there.
Of
dental procedures.
In this book?
The book that staff put together.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I was looking in the wrong one.
Okay. Just so everybody understands what my intent is, we're going to go until 12:30, and then we'll come back at 12:30. We're going to have to stop into your lunch. I've got Senator Shields, who has each of 5 or 6 questions, and then. For 12 years, forgive me.
Doesn't this happen to me?
Senator Ferriol.
I'd like to be on that line as well, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Yes, I was a good boy. I kept my mouth shut and just wrote down questions. As you started out, in fact, I want to make a comment just real quick. Last night I had a little meeting with the head of the Medical Society of Oregon, and he was talking about how many doctors are moving out of state because of the exposure of malpractice and insurance costs, and I was wondering if that's just unique to Oregon and not as bad other places, or what's causing that. And I don't know if you want to respond or if that's in your...
When Dr. Sandek comes up, I'll let him. He's more knowledgeable.
Okay. That might be a good question to talk about. You told us a lot in your presentation as you started off really fast, and I kept up with you for a while at least, and what you were saying was that Medicaid, CHIP, et cetera, would be out there whether there was an Oregon Health Plan or not.
Mr. Chair and Senator Shields, of the 450,000 people who are on the health plan, 340,000 of them, if we did away with the health plan, would still be covered under Medicaid and CHIP.
Okay, now that leads to a kind of a two-part question. We're looking at cost savings, and Senator Farioli and others have pointed out places where we've done inadequate eligibility determination. So can we assume that as the percentages are about the same, that the inadequate eligibility determination is percentage-wise the same within the Medicaid part as it is within the new eligibles part?
Mr. Chair and Senator Shields, there will, and put this off to someone else who's going to be testifying later, because you will have staff from other parts of DHS who can answer that, because this, for new eligibles, there's different criteria there than if someone qualified for TANF or SSI, the other categories. So, again, I'll ask to defer that to someone who knows the answers.
I certainly wouldn't want to speak for Senator Farioli, but I would be very interested in knowing the differential between the accuracy of the eligibility information in those two categories. The point that you made, though, in that first part of your presentation was that the Oregon Health Plan itself has actually shrank since you were leading in 1995. It's shrunk by 20,000 people.
So those who are only eligible. Because
the new eligible part, just OHP, shrunk.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Another question. You talked about moving the line. You talked about moving the line, on the famous list. You said you could move it within the appropriation without a bill, and the way I interpret it, that is that we could move that line, or you could move that line to react to increased medical costs out in the marketplace, but you couldn't move the line to actually reduce the overall cost of the Oregon Health Plan. Would that be an accurate statement?
Mr. Chair and Senator Shields, yes. If you want to actually lower the amount that's been appropriated, then you would have to have a bill to do that.
But the point, Mr. Chair, that I want to make is that they could actually move the line. Once we set our appropriation to stay within the amount of that appropriation, they could move the line to keep the cost from going up.
And may I qualify something on it, Mr. Chair and Senator Shields? In the legislation for the original Oregon Health Plan and then also our waivers, it's the legislature who makes that. We would not administratively move the line. The legislature has to make that decision. There has to be an action.
Or at 414735 section 2, we can suggest that if you do have a plan,
to the
right.
I want to thank you for the chart, and I labeled box one and box two on here. In the box two, you refer to DHS adults outreach,
mm-hmm.
And I wrote down outreach. What kind of outreach, and how's the 10.6 million saved? Or is that on that side? It's not a savings. That's a cost. That's a cost.
Mm-hmm.
Is this in any way related to, we had a battle earlier this year in one of the special sessions about cutting food stamp outreach? I mean, outreach in one category can end up being outreach in another category. How do those interrelate, and how do you...
Mr. Chair and Senator Shields, I'll talk generally, and if we have specifics to add, I'll ask her to do that. This is generally saying, as you have publicity about the fact that there's going to be some expansion on the Oregon Health Plan, more people find out about it and realize, oh, I could qualify even today. And so I'm not, maybe you can, I'm not sure how the estimate was made of the 10.6 or what that assumes.
Mr. Chair, Senator Shields, the estimate is indeed an estimate, and we can be significantly. It may be less than that. It could be more than that. But one of the things we saw, as Gene said, we talked about publicity for a new program. That there is a group of folks out there who could qualify today who are likely to come in. Would it be this many? This may be a high estimate in that respect. But also, there will be some aggressive outreach then in the FEOC program, trying to reach out to the, in particular, the employer-based group. A piece of what we will need to do, and what is done today, is to let folks know that there is another program being the public program for those who would qualify there, and generally they're persons who don't have employer-based coverage, but they learn as a part of this outreach activity that the program is available. And so we expect that when information is provided to the community in general, we'll see some folks coming in as a result of that. And we didn't want to, and looking at state budget neutrality, we didn't want to understate the potential impact of increased caseload that we didn't directly go out and bring into our programs. We wanted to make sure there'd be adequate money, thinking fiscally, in a fiscally prudent manner, to cover those folks.
Lynn, how did you arrive at the $10 million figure?
How
did you arrive at the $10 million figure?
That was based upon this assumption of the that they would come in over time, over a 6-month period, once the publicity activities began, and then
what kind of publicity activities are you talking about?
In that respect, I think at some point it would be helpful to have Rocky King come and speak about the PEOP program. Because they have a plan worked out in terms of how they're going to do outreach.
Am I understanding correctly that $10 million is mostly focused towards the PEOP program?
No, it's focused towards us. It's the spillover that will come from their outreach, and it is the activities that we'll be engaged in will be the general community. There are plenty of people out there who will help us let the populations in their community know that the Oregon Health Plan has an expansion that is...
Okay, hang on just a second. I got a $10 million. I'm going to start your program. And how many people were you expecting to pick up via this outreach program?
That's the period where we're phasing in, and it assumes that in 0103, that is 14,000.
So if we divide 14,000 into 10 million, that'll give us the... per person cost.
And the per person cost that's used here is what we pay today for these eligibles that are only eligible as a result of our current waivers.
Well, but how do these people normally get into the program? I mean, I guess I'm wondering why we need a $10 million outreach program. Do you think that a 50% of people show up at a church or something?
That's the prior question I was asking. I don't think this is money that's being spent on outreach per se. This is the additional cost to the Oregon plan because of the publicity for the outreach, which doesn't cost much of anything. I think you've got to be clear about that.
That's correct. What we wouldn't want to do is just spend all the savings on expanding and have more people come in through the current program. And so what this does is give us a cushion of assuming by having publicity, more people are going to come in who would currently qualify.
I was assuming you're going to send something about to advertise the program.
Oh, no, no.
Mr. Chair, I misunderstood that, and indeed, we don't have a dollar amount budgeted in order to do that kind of outreach.
If I could use a little different example, over in the Hunger Relief Task Force, we have a VISTA volunteer, I think, out in Harney County or someplace like that. And for that person, we're paying maybe $5,000. It's a volunteer, basically. But because they are there and doing some work out in the community and people are finding out, it is estimated that they may be able to actually bring $1 million of federal money,
yes,
food stamps, mm-hmm, into that county. And so that's a real, I mean, it costs us almost nothing. And the benefit to the economy out in that county is significant because those people will obviously be spending their food stamps out there. I'm suggesting that the actual outreach cost is going to be small. I'd like to know what it is. Maybe it's $50,000, maybe it's $100,000, but the $10.6 million is actually the increased cost to the health plan itself.
Mr. Chair, Senator Shields, there is not a dollar amount budgeted in order to do the actual outreach. We will do some information sharing, and it will be targeted to providers and managed care plans and to our agencies, and there will be and its clients, of course, in terms of understanding how to work within this new environment. And there will be some information made available publicly, you know, changes to brochures and that sort of thing, but not an identified amount to actually go out and to market.
Hmm. Mr. Chair, I have several other questions, but I'll limit myself to just this one. Jill, you, Jean, excuse me, you started it. You started it. Okay.
I call her Vicky, though.
Yeah, you call her Vicky. How many years have I known you?
Many,
yeah,
many years, yes.
Okay, George. Your big question, and you said this is the big question, you know, is what the minimum expansion will be that the federal government would require, you know, us to do in the expansion. Question in my mind is, have you set up a methodology to proactively try to determine what that minimum is going to be?
Mr. Chair and Senator Shields, we have not at this point. And frankly, part of what until we get waivers in hand, we don't want to now, you know, to go back to the federal government and say, well, we really don't want to do this level of expansion. We'd like to do something less. We think it's important for us to have the waivers in hand, and then we can begin talking with them about the expansion. We will have a lot of flexibility on the benefits side, it appears. And so a question might be, even for us, is it more important to cover more people and cover less services? And I think those are questions that we'll need to deal with the legislative assembly.
All right. Do you have a quick question for us?
What's the new waiver that's coming? Clearly, we're talking about the possibility in the next biennium to expand the program with additional people. We're also talking about the fact that among the new eligibles, they will be paying premiums. And my sense is that if we don't cap those premiums and keep them pretty low, in an economy that's in recession and in a period of time when poverty is growing in this state, that you're going to be excluding people who can't afford the premium. So have you thought about those consequences?
Mr. Chair and Senator Trow, it definitely is a concern. What we've tried to do is establish premium levels. It'll probably be pretty close to what someone at the same income levels would have to pay if they were purchasing individual coverage. And so, I'll look for it while I'm
keep them down, because a lot of, you know, we talk about comparing to other people who have health insurance, but a lot of us have a lot more income than the poor people do. And I know, especially seniors who have a lot of medication, they're spending a lot of copay.
I think, Mr. Chair and Senator Trow, it is a concern. It's definitely a concern, and that was a big issue. That was the main issue in our waiver committee, were copays and premiums. To give you a sense of what some of the levels are, and they are in the waiver. Again, this is for OHP standards.
person between 51 and, I'm sticking with that, 51 and 65% of poverty would be paying $15 a month. If they're up at 171 to 185, total coverage under OHP standards for all, that's the premium. They have to pay that to even get coverage, and they take co-pays for that is listed on the benefit.
It's a premium and co-pay.
Yes. Oh. For someone who's making 171 to 185% of poverty, they pay $125 a month. And so the state would be picking up half the cost of their coverage, approximately half the cost of their coverage. They'd be picking up the other half, plus they would have co-pays. But it definitely
is. How many people that will exclude?
How many of that will exclude? Well, initially, since we're only going to 110% of poverty, they're completely excluded now.
Yeah.
And so we do assume that as we, well, I'll give you what we would have in 101 to 125%, $23 a month. One of the concerns we've heard a lot from the advocacy community especially is that as we get a tougher premium policy and we raise premiums and you have co-pays on top of that. Paying the co-pays may mean they can't afford the premium and they may lose coverage. I don't want to say no one's going to lose coverage. That may happen. I think what we're trying to do a balanced, responsible job here of trying to say what might be possible. But it certainly is an issue of concern. We will be, as part of our ongoing monitoring, just tracking how many people lose coverage for non-payment of premiums.
All right, we're going to have just one little agenda here, okay?
These co-pays are not mandatory.
Yes, they are. For this, Mr. Chair and Senator Fisher, for the OHP Plus, the separate co-pays the legislature dealt with, those are not mandatory. But for OHP standards, these 110,000 people, they are mandatory under Medicaid law. Now, for hospitals, and we talked about this, as you know, a lot in the waiver application steering committee, for hospitals, there are other non-Medicaid, other federal laws that they have to follow. And so a hospital cannot turn down someone needing emergency care if the inability to pay. But as for Medicaid law, and so I would say for other types of providers, they are mandatory. If a provider wants to say, that's fine, I won't collect it, fine, but they are mandatory. And actually, I think when Dr. Santa comes back, he might share with you the experience in Washington where they've had a similar kind of thing under the Washington Basic Health Plan with a similar type of clientele and what their experience has been on co-pays.
Okay, on that note, we're going to go ahead and break. We're going to come back actually at 2 o'clock. The Senate Democrats have a caucus at 1:30. The Senate Republicans have a caucus at 3, so we'll be here for roughly 1 hour. And we'll test everyone's tolerance and where this presentation goes from there at that point. Please hold on to your questions. And I think as a final summation, so far, most of my concern still revolves around the financial accountability and the check and or balance that either exists or don't exist in this program. It seems to me that there's an excessive amount of leakage and that some of the resources are not being used to their full extent. Anyway, that's one of the areas that I think I want to spend a little bit more time. We did give you a list of questions that and hopefully you'll be prepared to respond
to. Yeah, and Mr. Chair, I think most of those questions would be directed at two people, and Jim Neely, who's here today.
You can bring up whomever you choose. We're going to help them back to order. I believe we're going to start with Mr. Neely and Dr. Santa, is that correct? Oh, no, wait, we had additional questions. Correct.
I think Senator Gordley has some questions she wanted to ask.
Why don't we bring you back up, Jean, and whomever else you want to bring in. Senator Gordley, do you have a series of questions that you would like that answered?
I do. Okay. Yeah.
Go ahead. You have the floor.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I, Ms. Thorne, would like to get a better feel, a more accurate feel for the need that is not being met by the Oregon Health Plan. And so I'm going to ask about the wait list that you referenced and just make sure I understand who is sitting on each of the various wait lists. For example, the CHIP wait list.
For the record, Jean, for Mr. Chair and Senator Gordley, the wait list I referred to is for the FEOP program, which caps enrollment currently. And so there are about, which is the subsidizing private coverage, there are somewhere, I'd say, next close to 20,000 people who are on that wait list.
20,000,
and there's 4,000 or so who are served in the program. For the other Medicaid parts of the program, OHP and CHIP, there are no wait lists. Those are entitlement programs. So if a person qualifies, they're made eligible. There are broader issues around the uninsured in Oregon, and if you wanted information about that, perhaps when Dr. Stanta comes up, he could address that. But the one program that does keep a wait list because it already caps enrollment is the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program.
All right. So then, just to follow up, Mr. Chair, while there are no specific wait lists for CHIP or any other category, we do have a way of capturing somewhere what the need is.
Yes, and I would just, when Dr. Santa comes up, I think you can address that.
All right. One other question. It kind of goes to the question that was raised by the chair earlier about the benefit. What is the benefit of the Oregon Health Plan? Could you provide a perspective for us, please, on this question in this way? Without the Oregon Health Plan, then what is the safety net out there in our communities to provide health care for Oregonians?
Mr. Chair and Senator Gordley, I'll take a stab at it, and if Lynn wants to add, and then again, maybe when Dr. Santa comes back up, since I've been away from this for a little while. I think the first safety net is the hospital emergency room. Person comes in, has no coverage, has an emergency condition, they're going to have to be treated. And so the hospital emergency room certainly is the place where they would come. There are also federal quality health centers in this state and other what would be called safety net clinics that receive some level of federal funding. They do receive Medicaid funding for those who would normally be Medicaid eligible. I believe there, I'm not sure, I know there was a general fund appropriation to assist safety net, but I'm not sure if that ever was actually dispersed. I know I saw it on some cut lists a few times. But I think, and the federally qualified health centers also do charge co-pays for services to help for those who don't have any other coverage. But I think certainly my knowledge limited right now is that system has been strained and continues to be strained. And so I think that probably, again, you're looking at the hospital emergency room kind of being the place of last resort for many people to be here.
And then just two more questions. One, do we have available to us, and it may be in these materials that I haven't had a chance to look at completely, a document that describes by county but also legislative district usage of the Oregon Health Plan?
Mr. Chair and Senator Gordley, it will be distributed to you in just a moment. It is by county, and what you all wait a moment for you to receive that. And what you'll find is by county, you'll see the percentage. Well, there's census data as well, so you get a sense of the percentage of the county population being served by the health plan and CHIP. And so the percent of the population receiving benefits. This does not include the Medicaid Needy Program or qualified Medicare beneficiaries or those who are retroactively eligible, but it'll give you the bulk. What you can see from this is those areas that are shaded have an increase in percentage of their population that has received an increase last year to this year, percentage of the population receiving benefits. So, for instance, you could see Douglas County, 15.59% of the population received benefits under the Oregon Health Plan and or CHIP. And this is the entire health plan, so it would include those who are categorically eligible. So overall, what we have on the state total is about 12.1% of the state population in July was receiving benefits under the health plan.
If I could follow up, Mr. Chair, is there an additional document or a way of looking at this information contrasted with the safety net that you described, for example, so that we could see an actual number, the total number of Oregonians receiving whatever the health services existing are in one picture?
Mr. Chair and Senator Gordley, I don't think there'd be anything easily accessible, and maybe the federally qualified health centers might have that information. The hospitals, I don't know that we'd be able to see if they would have an unduplicated count of who they provided uncompensated care to. So I don't know of anything. Maybe Dr. Snatter went like this, so maybe when he opens up again, he could let you know if there's something that's available.
In addition, Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, you may want to consider in the future asking Ian Kim to come testify to the committee related to the safety net system and his work also with there's work on developing a data system that would help get to some of those issues in the future.
One last question, and I appreciate the format that you just gave us, but can you take us deeper into the data and disaggregate it by race and ethnicity?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, apparently we could do. I don't know that we have regular reports that we do that on. But.
Mr. Chair and Senator Gordley, we do have data within our MMIS data system on race, essentially, is the data that's carried there, and it's as accurate as it's reported to us, and we could do that breakout for the Medicaid portion of the information that we're in the data.
Again,
what would be the purpose of doing so?
In order to look at access, how the health plan is being accessed by traditionally, historically underserved communities. This gives, what we have here gives us an overall snapshot of.
So I can help understand. Are we assuming then that there are certain individuals who are in the poverty range, income range that are not having access or gaining access by virtue of their race, or just trying to understand the relevance? Issue with the poverty issue.
Oh, not only would I assume that, I would say that is a fact.
Okay.
And there are others in the advocacy community who could testify about those problems.
Well, there's a reason to believe that may be the case. So.
Okay. Mr. Chair and Senator Gordley, you know, back in my days when I was sorry, I remember we did have on a statewide basis, I didn't know if we had on a county basis a breakout, so we could be looking at, for instance, is the Hispanic population. Here we have this this breakout of people under poverty, what percentage of them are on the Oregon Health Plan, to get at the issues of whether the persons of color, for instance, are being underserved. And I assume that's kind of the question of are people who would be eligible, are they accessing the services equally, or are there certain populations that may not be accessing?
Exactly. And Mr. Chair, the point is that without more complete data, we don't have as complete a picture as we could have about how all Oregonians are being served. So having disaggregated data to look at is more useful than having the the big, this one.
Right, Senator, the reason I guess I asked the question is I think you could also draw maybe a negative opinion or view if you find one particular racial category is in some of the things overrepresented sense of utilization too. I don't know how what the racial issue, how that relates to the income poverty issue and how we make that relevant to the
I think, Mr. Chair, if I may, I think probably what Senator Gordley is looking for is that, for instance, if we know that let's say 10% of those living in poverty are of a certain racial group, but yet only 5% of those on the Oregon Health Plan are of that racial group, then there's some question about are persons of certain racial groups or ethnic groups accessing the system less than you would think that they would be. And so I think there have been issues about medical care to certain access to medical care for certain ethnic groups.
Yeah, and I guess what I'm saying is maybe a negative side of that too. If one looks at the raw data and says a certain population, ethnic population, has a higher utilization of the Oregon Health Plan, that there may be a negative connotation drawn from that without some better understanding of how that
Mr.
might
Chair,
be.
If we were able to, and I think it was probably the data sets to look at, how does that equate to what the census would show as the total population of those under poverty by racial
group. Well, great. If you can bear with me, whatever you bring back, let's try to bring back something that I guess you can articulate. Okay, do you understand what I'm saying? That I want to at least some articulation of what the data is based on some of the interpretation, how relevant it is.
That's a legitimate question. I don't have an issue with that at all.
Yeah.
But I think, I guess my further point is that we need to become accustomed to asking for and looking for that information. And, the folks who come before us need to come with that information. I'll just leave it there. I have one other question here. Jump to that. I have the tape of the previous hearings, and I'm just wondering, are there questions or concerns that we're missing?
Mr. Chair and Senator Gordley, I don't know if there are questions. It's been interesting listening to the hearing so far. I think the issues are very big and very complex, and I've heard concerns raised about are we overpaying, are we paying for things we shouldn't, and at the same time I'm hearing are we not paying enough. And so I think it would be helpful if this committee does continue to really hear all of those various perspectives, because I know as in the past as I worked on this and then as I was involved partially this last year, there are lots of different perspectives on these issues, and I would just encourage you to speak out because you'll hear a lot of conflicting opinions about what the problem is, and it's hard to put a finger on a problem. And just as there are concerns on eligibility about whether or not the processes are catching everyone, you can go to listen to advocacy groups who are very concerned that there is so much checking and it really is holding up health care to people. So there are many sides to these issues, and I just encourage you to pursue them. To continue.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
One of the questions I had earlier was, 110,000 people in the waiver-related Oregon Health Plan, Oregon Health Plan standards?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What's the cost for enrollee?
Mr. Chair, I'll need to get those numbers and bring them back, the exact numbers, but it would be somewhere in the neighborhood of probably a little over $300 per person per month. A number of these individuals have significant health care problems.
$300 per person per month?
Per month.
Okay, and then that is both federal and state money? And the ratio leverage is what?
It's approximately 40% state, 60% federal.
40%. Okay. That'll help isolate, I guess, the general cost of the health standard. Senator Ferriola.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to ask you, Mr. Chairman, about some more information about the waivers, the current waiver and the proposed waiver. And as I understand it, in general terms, the waiver that we currently have is designed to give Oregon a bit more flexibility in the allocation of costs and benefits. And if that's essentially the same sort of thing that we're trying to carry forward, except with possibly a little more flexibility to add additional caseload and change the benefit ratio. But my question is, under the current waiver, are we not required to meet the reporting requirements that would normally be on Medicare and Medicaid if we have an Oregon health plan? Does this waive any obligation that we have for adequacy of encounter data or required reports to HBFA?
Mr. Chair, Senator Farioli, guidance that is referenced in the encounter data, Secretary of State encounter data audience audit, is guidance from the federal oversight agency, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, and it is indeed guidance. One of the things that the Secretary of State did in doing their background audit work was contact CMS, the federal agency, to ask about those goals and guidance. And CMS had responded with that the guide was really intended to provide technical assistance to states, and that they had no higher expectations out of that in terms of complying with that guidance. And so we're looking to that as being, here is the ideal way to monitor and use the data, and that's something we should strive to, towards, but it's not a requirement.
Mr. Chairman, I think that is probably why we have such difficulty understanding how this program operates. The waiver isn't just the flexibility, which are what allows Oregon to offer a different suite of services at a different level of benefits, which admittedly are better than the benefits that would be available under Medicare and Medicaid in most cases. But it seems also to absolve the agency from reporting requirements and accountability requirements. I'd like to continue with this line. The Secretary of State, Mr. Chairman, indicates that the current system does not meet the Federal Balanced Budget Act of 1977, which does require reporting for Medicaid and Medicare services under four categories: inpatient services, long-term care, pharmacy, and non-institutional services. So I'm going to ask whether or not the waiver absolves Oregon from responsibility for meeting the Balanced Budget Act of 1997, the federal law. Does it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Farioli, I think I need to look into that a little further. In general, we do have had some waivers that would allow us to do things a little bit differently than they are in regulation. That's the purpose for a waiver in general. But also, we've been working with the federal government in terms of bringing into our program various requirements that came out of the Federal Budget Act in 1997. And one of the things that we're doing, for example, although we would have a waiver not to have to provide it, is that pharmacy encounter data. We're introducing that into we have an October to October contract cycle. That'll become a requirement in this upcoming October contract. So we are moving forward to do that.
Mr. Chairman, the answer anticipates my question. We have $900 million roughly involved in pharmacy services, but I understand that's the number.
Senator Farioli, I'll defer to the budget folks later if Doug Wilson comes in terms of the exact amount, but that $800 to $900 million is probably appropriate to the current biennium for our entire Medicaid program.
It's a nice round number, Mr. Chairman. We don't currently require any reporting on prescription drug encounter information. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ferrioli, we don't require in our contract that the managed care portion reporting counter data, and that's about maybe a fourth of that dollar amount that you mentioned is managed care drugs. And we will start requiring it in October. We have collected on a voluntary basis from plans pharmacy encounter data in order to set capitation rates. And the actuary has, independent actuary has determined that the data that was collected was adequate to set appropriate rates.
I'm assuming that we don't also collect long-term care or non-institutional services care or inpatient care encounter data if we don't do it for pharmacy.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ferrioli, I'm not quite sure what the non-institutional care is, but assuming it's related to persons in a long-term care setting, just outside of the skilled nursing facility. Those services are outside of the Oregon Health Plan and outside of the encounter data system. They're not part of managed care. So they're handled in the traditional payment systems, and indeed information is collected in order to make payments. For inpatient hospital services, that is part of required encounter data.
Mr. Chairman, I think it would be helpful if we had some idea from the agency of what data streams it collects, what encounter data it collects, what new plans for encounter data it intends. Because if we don't have any idea, the federal waiver is a great thing. It allows Oregon to have the Oregon plan. But I'm also afraid that the dark side of the waiver was that it simply absolved previous administrators from meeting minimum standards for accountability and reporting. And that's a clear theme throughout the auditor's report. There were recommendations that prescription drug encounter information be included and captured and correlated. And I understand that that is going to happen in October.
That is
just the sort of a relevancy that just comes to light today. I'd like to know what other data streams are going to be collected. And I'd like to know if we're going to use some mechanism to reconcile data that's currently unreconcilable. Because all of that feeds directly back into the capitation program. Mr. Chairman, I'd also like a much better understanding about how the capitation rate is set and how the capitation who does the capitation rate, how it's set, what the data streams are that are used, how the correlations are made, and whether or not there's any connection between the people that are setting the capitation rate and any beneficiaries under this program. I want to make sure that there's a third-party, arm's-length process for setting capitation and reimbursement rates that has nothing to do with anyone that is a beneficiary under this program. I need to hear that in there.
Mr. Chair and Senator Ferrioli, the actuary is PricewaterhouseCoopers, and I would imagine that at a later meeting, if you would like, the actuary is in California, but if you would like to have her come in and explain the process that they go through for setting capitation rates, she'd be happy to do that.
Thank you. And Mr. Chairman, I'd like to know who audits your organization internally. Do you have any third party that audits your organization internally?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ferrioli, there are the department, and this isn't an outside agency in this request, but the department has an audit unit which has a function related to looking at the organization. And so that's intended to get at issues of improving how we operate. Then separate from that, of course, there is the Secretary of State and their role in auditing state agencies, and that applies to us. We're picked up in annual Medicaid financial reviews through their office, and then I think they're called performance reviews, which get at things like encounter data.
So you do have
Mr. Chairman, you do have a an internal improvement process going on that involves outside folks looking at your program.
Mr. Chair, Senator Farrioli, the internal improvement process is for the department as a whole, and they are staff who are hired for that purpose, so they are DHS employees.
Mr. Chairman, does PricewaterhouseCoopers perform any other functions besides setting a capitation rate for the agency?
Mr. Chair, Senator Farrioli, they do two functions for us that are interrelated. One is they set what we call per capita cost. So they look at providing the information that allows us to overall look at what is the cost going to be of the Oregon Health Plan for the upcoming budget biennium. And out of that work, they pull out the components that are related to managed care, and then the capitation rates are set based upon the first piece of work. So they're looking both at our fee-for-service utilization and expenditures and our managed care utilization and costs.
Do they provide written reports, Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Chair, Senator Farrioli, they do. They provide very detailed reports, and if it's your desire that you have the most recent ones, we could provide those.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to see the most recent ones, at least the executive summary, because I won't understand the rest of it. Mr. Chairman, just another couple quick questions. Today we discussed the idea of folks coming onto the program on a copay basis or a fee-out basis, where they would actually pay some premium. And we were told if they cannot afford to pay the premium, they'd have to go off the program. And we I was given to understand that they'd stay off the program for 6 months if they could not pay a premium. How do they get back on the program?
Mr. Chair and Senator Farrioli, there are two pieces to this. Because we are now moving to a six-month uninsurance requirement for those on OHP standards, which will be consistent with what we're doing in the FEOP program as well. If someone is under the poverty level, because there is an entitlement for those people under Senate Bill 27, if they go off, then they will have to have their six-month period of uninsurance, and then they will come back on and go through the application process. If they are over the poverty level, even though it will be a very small program initially, because we will be capping enrollment, they potentially have, there's the possibility it will be even longer than that, because they may need their six-month period of uninsurance, but then the program may be closed because we may have closed because of capped enrollment.
So in a case where the person is unable to make their premium payment and they become ineligible for the program for that reason, don't they just end up at the emergency room?
Mr. Chair and Senator Farrioli, that is a possibility, yes.
Okay.
I think what obviously we're trying to do is balance the, there are many concerns about, we have a premium policy with little teeth in it. And so there is teeth are being put into it, and there are those possible consequences.
And Mr. Chairman, do you have any information on cost shifting? It was clearly a situation of cost shifting, not only between the agency and HMOs, and the HMOs and the service and care providers, but also between the agency and hospitals, doctors' offices, and clinics. Do you have an analysis of cost shifting caused by your agency?
Caused by our agency?
Well, I mean, if we end an eligibility, we're shifting costs to the hospital.
Mr. Chair and Senator Farrioli, because we haven't done that yet. No, we don't have an analysis because it hasn't happened yet. There are reports, I believe, again, Dr. Santa may be able to refer to them out of the Office of Oregon Health Policy and Research on cost shifting generally.
Although I think part of the assumption with the health plan standard is that we're minimizing that shift by the fact that the program exists, although I think we talked about earlier, we couldn't necessarily quantify that.
Hey, Mr. Chair, I mean, we obviously can quantify the reduction in charity care that has occurred through hospitals, but as I said, we don't have data on physicians and other providers because that isn't the data. They're not required to report that kind of data.
Okay, and last question, Judge. If the agency were to implement this proposed prescription drug data collection system and you found that it would, by some odd quirk of accounting,
create some savings. Let's say a modest amount, $10 million on a $900 million expenditure. What would become of that $10 million? Would that go back to the general fund, Mr. Chairman? Would it, or would it just be consumed within the agency in some other service area?
Mr. Chair, Senator Farioli, first I clarify that the dollar value of the director is probably about $250 million that's in capitation. But what would happen if we were to reduce capitation rates in the future as a result of a revision that comes from a future rate setting process where the encounter data doesn't support rates at the level they are today. Generally, that would be something that we would know about during the budget development process, because this work is done before budget development, as opposed to us coming in during the course of a contract cycle and reducing capitation rates. So until such time as the capitation rates were changed, any benefit accrued to the plan and may be used to that managed care plan. And since they're capitated and expected to provide the full range of care, it may be that they don't have enough money to fund other parts of other types of services, and they may utilize that money for physician services, for example.
Chairman, I think that's part of the frustration that I'm feeling in this process. I want to make sure that this program is sustainable. I want to make sure that it's accountable, and I want to make sure that it stays solvent. What I'm hearing is that, like those certain celestial bodies from which not even light emerges, that once an asset goes into this program, it disappears into a black hole. I was hoping that what we'd hear is that the Secretary of State's audits, which are now 10 months old, trigger within the agency the desire to become accountable, to meet the minimum federal requirements for reporting, and to be able to show potential improvements in performance and efficiencies which will result in savings. But what I'm hearing is that the accountability piece is still a matter of waiver, that meeting the minimum requirements of federal reporting is super cost a lot of money, notwithstanding the good public policy objectives of accountability, that there will be at least a prescription drug encounter data that would be correlated, but no real strategy for improving the capitation process by creating a mechanism to reconcile unreconcilable data, and that if savings accrue to this agency, they'd certainly be gobbled up in the budgetary process. And I guess what I'm trying to get across to people is there doesn't seem to be a recognition that this program is close to system failure because of its cost. And we're trying our best to make it a universal health care program for people up to 185% of the poverty level. At a time when Oregon's private sector has lost over $22 billion, and even though these dollars are heavily leveraged from the federal government, 40-60, dollars in the state government are pretty scarce. And unless there's some accountability, unless there's some potential for savings, unless we look at this program not as a slot machine that pays out 6 to 4, unless we start looking at this program like the investment of $2 billion in state assets that have to be accountable, that have to be accounted for, and have to be operated in a manner consistent with the best practices of the private sector in terms of efficiencies, we're going to lose the system. Right now I can make just as strong an argument for not granting the waiver as you've made for granting the waiver because of the lack of accountability. And other people are probably making that argument. I'm not making that argument. But this system's going to crash if we keep pushing it to the wall and pat dancing around the issue of responsibility and accountability. And if there are no savings possible, then I wonder about whether or not the program's running in any way in an accountable manner. Because I couldn't explain it to people. A $1.9 billion program, but you can't make any savings. You want to serve more people and expand the program, give it a potential $340 million increase in cost just on the base that we have. But we can't make any savings. Because any savings will be gobbled up in other areas and services. And
I personally don't see how you get around your spending limitation issue. You know, you're having to go back to the e-board for increases in the service levels for the waiver. How do you get around the expenditure limitation for the agency? If you find $10 million that was allocated, you just go ahead and spend it elsewhere.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Perioli, during the interim, the Department of Human Services comes into the emergency board every 6 months, I believe it is, looks back, where are caseloads, what are the costs per person in the health plan and services to abuse and all of that, and rebalances, and that's part of the rebalance plan process to look at, are there areas, and throughout the Department of Human Services, you have basically entitlement programs, are there areas that are over budget, under budget, and how do they balance out, and are there additional management actions that have to be taken to stay within budget, and that's been a process that's been in place since the early 80s, and so the emergency board does look at this every 6 months and decide whether or not if there are savings in OMAP, they should be applied elsewhere in the budget, or if they're, and if they're over budget, what are the management actions to take to stay within budget?
Senator, I think you raise a number of interesting issues because this is an extremely complex area of public policy. And I think that one of the issues this committee, or you know, assuming that we continue on through the rest of the year, should focus on are particularly the financial accountability of the agency and what kind of mechanisms are in place to ensure that financial accountability is occurring. And I'm particularly interested in the agency's response. We'll hear about this later, I assume, response to the audit report and some questions that were asked or given to Ms. Thorne and others earlier. And I'm really very interested in the questions that you asked, Senator Perioli, about the waiver issue and the waiver from federal requirements. And in doing that, the absence of information provided to the Legislative Assembly, and I'm kind of bridging in my thinking, the role of the legislature, because we don't generally like to micromanage agencies, but on the other hand, it's clear that there are not a lot of financial controls that are in place here that would give us the assurance that money is being spent consistent with what our constituencies would expect in terms of financial accountability, et cetera. So, one last little question here. How many other states have a similar program where they're insuring populations above the federal poverty level?
Mr. Chairman, we'll need to get back to you. When we started, we were the only one. But
there are probably
10 to 20 states now.
10 to 20, okay.
Many of them have eligibility at higher levels than we're proposing.
Yeah, and I hope that you all don't take from comments from the committee that, you know, ascribing any blame or, you know, imputing blame to you or others. I think it's just that the state has an interest, the legislature has an interest in making sure that we have certain mechanisms in place, like things spent wisely. The Secretary of State's audit report really surprises me, and I'm thankful that it's as blatant as it is. But I just got a copy of the federal act regarding what Congress did with respect to financial accountability on behalf of corporations, and we're interested in looking at that and seeing if there might be some parallels that we can apply in general, not just to the Oregon Health Plan, but perhaps to all agency directors and deputy directors in the state to ensure that those persons running state agencies are in fact held accountable for the financial position of the agency, so that those representations made with respect to dollars spent, public dollars, are in fact accurate and truthful. So that's kind of a predisclosure of the direction that I'm going at this point. So, Senator Toronto, you've got a series of questions that you'd like to ask, which you mentioned out to me.
I guess, you know, I've been around this program for a while, and I didn't realize that there was a serious accountability problem with the agency. Is there concern at the federal level about how this federal money is being spent and how our program's operating? Any unusual concern about lack of accountability?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Turo, I haven't heard of any yet. Neither have I. know, in general, the federal agency has looked to Oregon as being in as being one of the better states as it relates to encounters. I'm sorry, Senator Ferrioli isn't here. One of the better states in terms of encounter data collection. And validate.
So hold on a second. Did you just say what I think you said?
Yes, I did.
We're the leader, and
we're not the leader. Arizona would be the leader.
Arizona, are we second place?
We may be second. And so, as you can tell from that, this is an emerging field for states to wrestle with in terms of being able to provide good data out of the managed care arena. And in fact, prior to the passage of the Balanced Budget Act in 1997, there were no requirements on states unless they had a waiver like we do to provide encounter data. You didn't have to collect any data whatsoever. And so when we started the Oregon Health Plan in February of 94, that's when we started encounter data and started the learning curve. And we're continually improving taking the input from Secretary of State and someone to help us in that process.
All right.
The other thing with, as I listened to Senator Ferrioli, he mentioned the fact that some of the people who might not be able to afford the premiums or the co-payments and so forth would end up then not being admitted to the program, and would then eventually, if they had health problems, end up emergency room. It seems to me that a lot of people think about that, and then they think about the cost of the emergency room, and they think, gosh, that's terribly expensive, and it is. But it seems to me that there are other manifestations of what happens to those people if they aren't adequately covered with health insurance. And one of them is that they get sicker because they don't get any kind of treatment. And maybe that takes them to the emergency room, or maybe it doesn't. Maybe they fail in their job. Maybe they don't do well in school. Maybe they have all other kinds of failures. They get sick. Maybe they die. There are lots of more things other than just they end up in the emergency room. Because having good health care opportunity and availing yourself of it really does make your life a lot better. I think we ought to be really very grateful to you folks for providing that for so many of our people, and I wish you could do it for a lot more of them who need it.
Senator, thanks for that keyword. Of course, maybe. My question is, can you quantify any of that?
Well, some things are qualitative and can't be quantified, but boy, they're darn good quality.
Right, right. But, Senator, I do believe that we have a fiduciary responsibility.
We have a lot of people who
can attend to that. Mr. Chair, the Office of Health Policy and Research may have some broader studies that have been done around prevention and cost avoidance, cost savings because of that. Part of what the difficulty is here is that for those who are on the Oregon Health Plan and stay on the Oregon Health Plan, if they get earlier care, it may save us money. For those who aren't covered and come on and or go off, part of the savings can actually be to the private sector because the premiums don't have to go up as much to take care of the cost shift. So there are a number of places where there are savings, but the ability to quantify them, again, we have hospital cost reports. We don't have cost reports. I don't think we want to ask physicians and other providers to submit to the state cost report. So it's difficult to get our hands on exact savings.
Right. I appreciate that, and I don't disagree with you.
Yeah, I had a question a while ago. After Senator Ferrioli's question, you responded that potentially across the country we may be second best in the country with regard to the accuracy of our information. And as you described that, you were saying that there's 20 states that have kind of 10 to 20 that have gone beyond strictly doing Medicaid populations. My question is, are you saying that today there are 30 plus states with Medicaid programs that don't have any encounter data collection systems set up, or did that change in 1997 and now they all have to have it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Shields, that did change in 1997. Coming out of the Balanced Budget Act requirement. And now there are requirements related to collecting
in all states.
In all states that have a managed care program. And so we were just ahead of the curve because it was a requirement as part of our initial waivers back in 1994. So that's allowed us to move forward into to participate in the federal discussions that have led to their recommendations of what would make an ideal encounter data model.
So a follow-up to that. Since we got a head start, 94 as versus 97 or 98, whatever, would our encounter data collection system probably have evolved a little more than some of the other states and therefore maybe be still probably a little bit better than the average across the country?
Mr. Chair, Senator Shields, yes, I believe that is the case. But, you know, the standards we're aiming for obviously moves us in the direction of the recommendations that are out there, or guidelines that are out there from the federal agency.
And also the guidelines in the Secretary of State's audit, I would assume.
That is correct.
Chairman, may I follow up the question?
You can. Republicans have a 3 p.m. caucus. What time is it, most of them? And I don't think it's going to last too long. Any objections to coming back at 4:30? Any fervent objections?
I think a broader question is not just 4 or 4:30 or whatever, but in fact, I have a commitment that's going to, as I think, I mean, keep me from being here at 4:30. What's our plans for this weekend? Are we meeting at all over the weekend?
My understanding is we are going to have a floor session tomorrow at some time yet to determine the advanced calendar. So it would be my intent to come in at 9:30 tomorrow morning with this committee.
I have a conflict tomorrow, and I won't be able to be here. That's why I was asking the question.
You had to get filled in and eat something while you're gone.
And Senator Fisher will not be here Saturday as well.
Oh, well, he'll be here Saturday. Can you bond during the day? That's the question.
I'm not sure that I'll be here.
We're going to have a mutiny here.
No, not really. No.
Okay, well, we're going to keep this recess until after your question.
What I just heard was that the agency has better encounter data than many other states. Yet the agency agrees with the auditor's report that you don't meet the minimum standards for encounter data reporting. It's very clear here that the Secretary of State's audit shows that at least in two areas you fail to meet minimum standards for encounter data. One is in the prescription area, which is a requirement. The other one is just in grossest terms in encounter data on intake. There is also a clear deficiency in the chart reviews, doctor's chart reviews, and any plan eligibility reviews. And the agencies agreed with those audit exceptions. So how can we characterize this as being a superior program in terms of those audit exceptions?
Mr. Chair, Senator Farrelly, I don't think I would characterize this as being a superior program. I'm saying that the level of superiority out there across the nation is very low. Arizona has the longest experience and has devoted the most resources to getting the best encounter data, but that we're viewed to be probably second in line.
Mr. Chairman, I think you can cut to the chase here. Do we now currently meet all the federal standards for reporting? Either exceed.
Mr. Chair, Senator Farrelly, we meet the requirements of of the federal government of us. Our waiver indicates that we do not need to provide.
Mr. Chairman, that's circular. But we have a waiver so we don't have to meet any federal standards, therefore we meet or exceed all the federal standards. That's just circular discussion. Either we meet the criterion that the federal agencies would apply to us, said we know Oregon is fine, or we don't. Do we or don't we?
It is circular, but you're accurate. I mean, you're not being inaccurate. She's telling the truth.
Yeah.
But based on the waiver, they're not required to meet those standards, and therefore they're more likely to not.
That's absolutely true, Mr. Chairman. What I'm trying to get at is this. Because we have no federal requirements, do we have any requirements at all?
Mr. Chair, Senator Farioli, we do have requirements. The one requirement that would be applied to other states that isn't applied to us is the requirement to collect pharmacy encounter data. And we're now doing that a few weeks from now. That will also be a requirement that we will implement on the plan, managed care plan, and then that will bring us into that same range as other states.
Mr. Chairman, to facilitate my learning curve on this thing, I guess what I need to do is have a complete discussion with the director. Maybe it's a side conversation about what it is that legislators can expect in terms of a data stream that we can make sense of, so that we can fill our role as oversight authority for the state. Right now, what I hear is that since we have a waiver, we're out from under most of the federal requirements. There are some reporting requirements. There's certainly some deficiencies that the Secretary of State's identified. They may be being dealt with, but I'm not at all sure that I could, at this point, characterize what kind of data, what the accountability issues are, what kind of reviews, what kind of checks and balances there are, what kind of reports we can expect. And those things, I think, are minimum requirements for our role as an oversight agency.
And I think you raised a very good question, and I think it is a matter that the legislature should be concerned about. And assuming we had a waiver program and the absence of reports to the federal government for the purpose of federal government's needs, should there be substituted to some degree reports to the legislature on certain issues that we find relevant to the oversight of the program? Because it appears, and unless we're wrong, there is really nothing for the legislature. I know there are a few people out there who have a very specialized knowledge and understanding of what the health plan has been and what better officials
like to give. Yes, but you don't have any opportunity to make any input into it. Basically, they run it the way they want to run it.
Right. And you do this through administrative rule, I suppose.
They've openly said that they're not going to be responsible for any kind of basically disciplinary action or discipline within the ranks of the people sending them in the buildings and things like that. And they're talking now about going back and doing something with the HMOs. The HMOs are looking at these prescriptions themselves because they're required to pay them. They've probably got a lot more accuracy than that. What about the ones that are a fee for service that they're just being blindly paid, that aren't even being checked out to find out whether they're the proper level of number or anything else of what the prescription goes for? And frankly, I'm not concerned at all about what Mississippi or Tennessee or some other state does. I'm interested here. I don't care if we're the second best in the nation and nobody's doing anything. But, this is it's almost worse than a circular argument. It's trying to justify dumping.
Right, and I think due to the complexity of the issue that we're dealing with public policy, it seems to me prudent to have some.
They kick out a prescription because it doesn't have some goofy number or date filled out on it, and they don't even pay attention whether it's a valid reason or not.
All right.
Mr. Chair, could I just clarify what our schedule is? We're coming back at 4:30.
We're going to come back at 4:30. We'll work no longer than
5:30. All right. And then tomorrow morning, I have a commitment to Saturday School, a program that I coordinate. Up in Portland, we're getting started with the new school year.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, we'll be back at 9:30. So,
okay.
Absent members will be
absent. Just wanted to let you know. Thank you.
We'll have tape recordings and videotape and whatever else anybody wants to update themselves. All right. Yeah. So we're going to be in recess until 4:30. Come back to order, and. One, two, we can have a quorum. Dr. Shanna, your turn, and Ms. Nina. Dr. Shanna, you want to talk about healthcare cost drivers? Is that
John Shanna from Office of Oregon Health Policy and Research. There's three things that I'm prepared to mention. I thought I would lead off with issues around alternative ways to do capitation setting and what we're doing there related to 2519. Then some comments and explain some information that I've provided about healthcare cost drivers. And then finally, just a couple of follow-up comments on questions that have come up yesterday and today that I have some information on. Just let you know we have it if you're interested and give you some examples. So that's where I thought I would head.
Sure.
Okay. I think in your packet, there in your notebook under the tab.
Contractor reimbursement.
Contractor reimbursement. There should be some written comments from me that starts out, Senate Special Committee on Access to the Oregon Health Plan, John Santa, yesterday's date. And if you go down to the bottom of that, after the first set of bullet points, starting with HB 2519, let me address those issues first. Section 12 of that legislation directs the Department of Human Services to report to the 2003 legislature on alternative methods for arriving at a capitation rate. The department's requested that our agency pursue that project. We have completed a variety of startup tasks. The project involves four parts. An RFP will be released soon for consulting actuarial services to provide Oregon with options regarding cap rate methodologies. The state's currently contracted independent actuary, PricewaterhouseCoopers, will not be permitted to bid on this RFP. So an actuary familiar with Medicaid, familiar with alternative, with cap rate methodologies, will basically be asked to come in and help us identify other ways of developing a cap rate methodology. I might mention, and this is a nice little one-sheet summary that's available. It's not in your packet. There's 41 states that have capitated Medicaid programs. And I suspect you would know the answer if I asked you, what do you think a table of those 41 states shows in terms of how they do their capitation rates? They do it 41 different ways.
Okay.
Because of unique features to all 41 states' programs and areas. So we will have options for alternative cap methodologies for the 2003 legislature. Second, if you turn the page, we organized a work group to provide input to the process and the actuary regarding hospital reimbursement strategies. We realized one of the first questions that actuary would ask is, are you willing to look at different ways to reimburse hospitals? And so next week that work group will get together to start to talk about what kind of different hospital reimbursement methodologies might be worth pursuing. Likewise, the work group has been organized to provide input to the process and the actuary regarding physician reimbursement methodologies. Those sessions will start next week and will be held in public, and the focus will be on payment methodologies. And then finally, a third work group, 2519 Section 12 also calls for the state to look at comparator methodology so that doctors in Roseburg, for example, can more easily figure out how are they being paid by their Medicaid HMO in Roseburg vis-a-vis doctors in Portland or doctors in Eugene, a comparative methodology. And I think that's one of the most interesting parts of Section 12. Because right now, that information isn't available to practitioners in the state. Payment levels in one area versus another.
Mr. Chairman.
Yeah,
is information like that not basically really bordering on FTC collaboration? Because, I mean, it would certainly seem that they could get together or that they would have knowledge then that would allow them to fix costs and prices or whatever.
Mr. Chair, Senator Fisher, that's a good question. Realize information about what payment levels are is not the Federal Trade Commission's concern. Independent competitors discussing that information and organizing joint efforts to affect those reimbursement rates is of concern.
But we found out once in one of our committee meetings when we were dealing with some of these things that if we made public what one particular company was doing, that basically we were told we pursued this to the federal level. And they did not allow us basically to do that with the idea that once that was knowledgeable, then that would anybody that did a price or anything like that would be subject to.
Mr. Chair, Senator Fisher, we'll take your concern under advisement. We'll get back to you. My impression is comparative information can be shared with practitioners.
Doctor, what's the utility of having that available? What difference does it make?
Well, I think it there's been concerns about, Mr. Chair, there's been concerns about, we know the dollars start up here, and we know what we get as an individual. We're very uncertain about what happens between here and there in terms of what do the hospitals get, what do the doctors get, what do I as an individual doctor get.
Okay. Senator Ariel.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. We've seen a couple of different efforts at establishing reimbursement rates for doctors and hospitals. And it's been a matter of intention, at least, and the controversy over the capitation rates and the reimbursement rates, I think, is pushed a little bit by the demographics of rural communities. And what dynamic has played itself out is if a community has a high rate of unemployment and low average wages and lower than average household income on a per capita basis, those translate, at least they have been translated by those that do capitation rates, into lower costs for medical care. And the way they arrive at that is that in an area of high unemployment and lower average wages, your labor costs are lower, therefore your medical costs are lower. And so instead of looking at perhaps a better indicator, which is the state has to subsidize with direct tax credits the retention of physicians with the $5,000 annual tax credit, which is permanent now. And it has historically been very difficult to retain and recruit quality nursing care and medical specialists, particularly surgeons, radiologists, and medical specialists like phlebotomists and cardiologists to rural areas. Yet to be viable, every one of those small hospitals has to have a suite of professionals that can be available. We've got apparently conflicting public policy. The capitation rates are driven down by the unemployment averages, the low average wages, the low per capita income. And so capitation rates for reimbursement clinics and hospitals tends to be lower than in urban areas. And on the other side of that conflict, we're doing everything we can to incent the retention of doctors in rural areas with direct tax incentives, and we're doing the AHEC program with the Oregon Health Sciences University, spending millions and millions and millions of dollars to recruit and retain and locate doctors and to keep hospitals up, and that's why we have an A and B hospital reimbursement thing. So I want to be sure, I want to have the assurance out front that when you put this RFP together, you don't bias capitation rates against rural Oregon. Because that is exactly what's happened consistently when we set these reimbursement and capitation rates. And the frustrating thing for me is that we're using a poor quality of living standard to help depress the reimbursement rates for hospitals and doctors and healthcare professionals, which further erodes the quality of living in those communities. So I'd like to hear your assurances that will not be a built-in bias in the RFP for capitation.
Directly, and why we don't, some of our rural areas have a managed care.
We'll get to that.
That's the other response. But thank you,
Mr. Chair, Senator Perioli. I think the RFP is clear in directing that the actuary should be open to a variety of different options, and that would certainly be an area, given that one question that arises about the current cap rate methodology is whether it adjusts correctly for type A, type B, for example. So I'm certain that that will be an area of interest and discussion, and the RFP is clear in the actuary being directed to look at options that either the actuary or these work groups percolate up with.
Mr. Chairman, you know, I've heard the expression eggs are cheaper in the country, but it doesn't cost you any less to break your leg in Grant County than it does downtown Portland. As a matter of fact, when you add the time and distance factors and the travel difficulties and the distance issues and the, especially the medevac question, medical care in rural communities can be more expensive, not less. But that's not what the capitation rates would show you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Trope.
Does the RFP describe what we expect about process that the winning actuarial firm will use to establish the capitation rates? Are they going to come and be in Oregon and take a look personally, or is it something that's done back in headquarters and just under some options? How's it going to be done?
Let me have Bob Dupree from my office respond to that question, Senator.
For the record, I'm Bob Dupree, Deputy Administrator of the Office of Policy and Research. We did require in the RFP that not that any specific number of trips to Oregon be made, but that they come to the state to see on the ground what's happening and talk with people. We're also going to, of course, make available.
They're going to talk to people.
Yeah, and we will make available to them.
Since they talk to Senator Perioli, because he's concerned about a particular group of providers in the area of the state.
Noted.
So that's what you intend to have them do, is to come and survey the state and figure out what the problems are and how the present capitation rate is serving us as well as providing us options.
That is correct.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator.
2 years ago, there was a task force that was entangled in the legislature that did a tour of rural Oregon and visited healthcare facilities across the state. I think probably 10 or 15 legislators participated. And there was a real impression formed in that group about time, distance, and difficulty of providing adequate availability of medical services. And perhaps the findings of that group could be shared with this RFP organization.
All right. Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sorry to not be here, and I hope this is not going to be redundant when I ask this question. Do we have any, and I'm hoping that this is the group that can answer the question. When we, in 1994, established Oregon Health Plan, you know, this was to be an experimental plan, and that we were going to be delivering the services through managed care rather than fee-for-service. Right now, if you just step back and compare what we're doing with the, 30 states that are not doing what we're doing, how do we compare similar visits as far as payment to hospitals, physicians, whoever, to the provider for similar care? In other words, fee for service under Medicaid versus what we're doing here in the Oregon Health Plan.
Mr. Chair, Senator George, there are studies that address those issues. There's always an apples and oranges issue because all these states do it differently. They have different benefit plans. They have different reimbursement strategies. But there is some degree of information available regarding that. For example, we have made the folks involved in this effort aware of a study done in California by Lewin that looked at comparative reimbursement rates for physicians by state.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's Oregon listed with the other 50 states. Actually, Oregon compares pretty well to the other 50 states for primary care services. It does not compare particularly well for surgical services. Recall that in the early 90s, there was kind of an emphasis on incenting more primary care and more people to go into primary care by increasing primary care reimbursement. It doesn't get at the adequacy of that, it's just a comparison. But some of that information is available. It's a bit more difficult on the hospital side, because hospital services are more difficult to compare. I'm not aware of comparative data on hospitals, but we can we'll get you that if you're interested.
Okay, I may still have it too. What we received 2 years ago. Can I have a follow-up question on that?
Sure, go ahead, sir.
One of the things that in the Secretary of State's audit report, it talks about the fact that many of the plan providers, you know, what they're doing is they're leaving, and they pointed out back in September 2000 that they had lost a total of $6.3 million. My understanding is today that that hemorrhage still continues, that people are losing money and are pulling out of being in a position of being a provider. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, I don't think that's quite correct. The era you're talking about did involve a transition from traditional insurance companies, Regents, Providence. Those plans have left the Oregon Health Plan for the most part. Providence remains in the plan, but in a much smaller way. They have been replaced by 15 organizations that, for the most part, with one or three or four exceptions, only do Medicaid, so that Kaiser is still involved, Providence to a small degree, Central Oregon in insurance and health services is a commercial insurance company and a Medicaid HMO. So they've been replaced by much smaller HMOs and, frankly, more vulnerable organizations that are by community for the most part. So there's an organization in Salem, from Marion Polk County, that's the major provider here, and one in Eugene, and one in Lynn Benton, and one in Roseburg, and two in Grants Pass. The state significantly increased reimbursement last October. That's made things a bit better. The plans have, I think, gotten through the year in reasonable shape. But there is, I think, appropriate concern that these are operations that work on a 1 or 2% margin. It would not take much of a medical shift for them to be more vulnerable. This is not Regents, who has $1 billion in the bank, or Kaiser, who has some substantial resources backing them up. But these are basically people in your community, and they are more vulnerable. My sense from talking to folks is they've hung in there this year. They will get another increase this October. The state's increases still fall short of what's happening in the market. The market is increasing so significantly. The market, as you'll hear in a minute, is what's driving this, not the state. The predominant driver is the industry's costs are increasing significantly. So comparatively, even though the state has increased resources, an argument can certainly be made that it's not enough. Janine Smith from our agency is managing that project, and we'll be happy to get back to you all with the information. Let me move to the second issue I was asked to report on.
Madam Chairman.
Senator Perioli.
I'm being told by the physician communities of Oregon it's about 49th out of 50 in physician reimbursement rates. That it's driving
the recruitment issue and retention issue. So do we have any, Madam Chairman, do we have any comparison in terms of physician reimbursements with other 50 states? Where do we rank?
Madam Chair, Senator Farioli, the report I mentioned earlier would give you some sense. I think overall, we're, my recollection is we're lower than average. We're in the I think, 30s in terms of states, upper 30s, 38, 39. That's my recollection.
And, Madam Chairman, is that overall reimbursement hospital doctors, healthcare facilities, or just physicians?
Madam Chair, Senator Farioli, the data I'm referring to is physicians only. I have looked and we haven't found a good hospital comparison. Realize the state reimburses type A and type B hospitals at cost. So in the scheme of things, that's good. It's the non-type A and type B hospitals that I think have the reimbursement issues because they're the ones at risk, if you will, from a reimbursement point of view.
If you, Madam Chairman, I'd like to request if we have any relative or comparative rankings on reimbursements, it would be helpful to have the community have that material.
Madam Chair, Senator, we'll get that to you. I would just point out there is a couple of documents in your packet with some details, a summary that looks like this of where we are with this project. We've done some baseline work and then what these work groups are doing. Section 12 of 2519, and then just the meeting notices for these work groups that are going to get started.
Senator Trill.
How do the work groups relate to the actuarial person with hiring? The work groups are going to go ahead now. We're going to get the actuary on board later. Are they going to be done by the time the actuary gets on board? Is that information going to be part of this study? How do they interrelate?
Madam Chair, Senator Trout, the work groups will be ongoing, and one of the major purposes is to interact with the actuary. Let me give you an example. The physician group, we will be asking, are any of you aware of an alternative to what's called RBRDS, the Medicare methodology for paying physicians? It's kind of become the most common methodology. There was some discussion and some concern last year because of the way the federal government changed RBRDS. The physicians were very unhappy with that. There is some ability by any payer to make adjustments in RBRDS. So we'll be trying to see if we can get some consensus. You know, do we continue to talk RBRDS, or do you all want to really think about an entirely different way of paying physicians? And what are the implications of that? And if we stick with RBRDS, which things really do you think we should look at modifying and have the actuary weigh in on this is workable, this isn't, so things of that sort.
So the description says provide input to, and each one of these little focus groups, whatever they are, and the providing input, I guess, eventually to recommendations that will be made to the next legislature. Session that that is, but somehow or other going to bring these all together with the actuarial as that person brings forward the options, right, of how we're going to do this, so that all of this information, recommendation, options goes to the next legislative session for it to do with it what it wants to do, is that it? Put it on shelf or something else?
Madam Chair, Senator Trill, that's correct. That's what the bill calls for.
So you're doing what the book
calls for. Let me turn to the second area. I was asked to prepare some brief comments about major drivers and would refer you again to the text of the brief memo I prepared. This, of course, is a huge area, an overwhelming amount of information, and so I'll be very brief given the hour, and I know the other things that you all have to do. It's no surprise, of course, to this group that the costs have risen. In particular, though, I want you to appreciate that costs are rising because of a number of unpredictable events in the economy, in the industry, so that the cost of taking risk becomes expensive. I mean, we all know that insurers are much more expensive post 9/11 because they're seeing a future that's more unpredictable and costly to them. That's true in health. That affects the insurance industry as a whole, so the cost of risk itself is expensive. All of the sectors in the industry are experiencing increased costs. And when you look at a population, the populations are different in terms of where the cost increases are. In the Medicaid population, for example, as you all know, we're particularly affected by prescription drugs. Many of those are good things. Mental health drugs have changed the face of mental health care, but they're very expensive, and financing those mental health drugs now and in the future is going to be a challenge. In contrast, commercial insurance, the leading cost center appears to be now hospitals. So it's different than Medicaid. And the issue there is utilization, but also labor costs. In your packet, I've included a couple of slideshows, PowerPoint presentations that I heard at a national conference, and a paper. Some of that information is specific to Medicaid. Some of it is one presentation is on commercial. And there's one slide in there that's, I think, particular interest because the researcher there has looked at to what degree are labor costs contributing to increased hospital costs versus utilization, and come to the conclusion that labor costs are significant at this point in time for a number of reasons. Some of it, again, is workforce. There isn't enough hospital workforce so to be competitive for the best workers, hospitals are having to increase their salaries. I've also in your packet given you a one page and then an example. Let me show it to you so you can see what it looks like. I can come up with it. It's a text that looks like this. And then there's a map, and this is just a printout of how this looks on the internet. This is an interactive website done by the Kaiser Family Foundation. But if you look here, you can basically choose any of these items and ask, where does Oregon rank? This, for example, is a map. You can't fully appreciate it because it's not in colors. It ranks states by the cost per Medicaid enrollee, Oregon actually is in the second tier. Its cost range between $3,759 and $4,445. But you can immediately see for all of these where Oregon would rank. I printed out, and I'm sorry I did this at home and it didn't quite work as well as I hoped, but here are the actual numbers. And you can see Oregon ranks 38 in terms of state spending per Medicaid enrollee, and we're at $3,162. Now that's 1998. That's the latest data that's available. So it gives you some idea of where we rank in terms of state. I took some of that data from that table and other sources. It looks like this. This comes from the federal government. It looks at what's called personal health care spending. The first sheet is for all personal health care spending, then for Medicare health care spending, and then for Medicaid. It shows you where we're at in 91, where we're at in 98, that's the latest data, what the average annual growth is, and what that is as a share of the state's personal health spending. I also put Washington data on there to see give you a sense of what our neighbors like. It's too complex, I think, to go through this evening. But at another time, if you'd like, we'd be happy to do that.
Excuse me, Senator Perioli.
The document that I'm looking at is the rising, the factors fueling rising health care costs. It's a paper in the handout. It's been by Freshwater.
Excuse me a second. Rick?
Yeah, some of those reports I put in there, so John may not have a copy of some of them.
Madam Chairman, the in Table 1 of the document, the factors driving rising costs, they list the trend. In general, inflation drives medical prices, rising providers, expenses, government mandates and regulations, decreased consumer demand, litigation and risk management are all listed. And I think those are all drivers that we can agree or have there. There's another category called fraud and abuse. And the percent of the total increase identified by Freshwater has been fraud and abuse is 5%. And I'm just wondering if when you have looked at the drivers, if you've analyzed the cost of fraud and abuse in the Oregon.
Madam Chair, Senator Perioli, I'm not aware of that analysis being done in Oregon. It may have been done. I'm not aware of what that number would be, so whether that analysis has been done.
Thank
you. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Stowe, did you have a question?
I was trying to say that I presume any program as big as a healthcare program, a statewide health program, that there's always a problem of fraud and abuse. And this is the average amount of estimation of what the cost is of the fraud and abuse in all these programs.
Madam Chair, Senator Trow, I would assume so. Let me just share with you, as a Blue Cross for 10 years, we were constantly pursuing fraud and abuse issues. My impression is the same thing is true here. I certainly turned over situations that I became aware of for one reason or another to OMAP to pursue in terms of fraud and abuse. I know those efforts are being pursued. I just can't quantify them for you.
The fraud and abuse all through the system. Some people who are the clients of the system obviously making false presentations and so forth, but also those who are the providers and the deliverers and so forth. Because there is some fraud and abuse there.
Madam Chair, Senator Trow, my experience has been as there's more money, there's more fraud or attempts at fraud and abuse. I had a physician send me a flyer that was sent to him by an out-of-state company basically suggesting that he and his colleagues should buy packaged prescription drugs from them and then give it to workers' compensation patients, that this company would give them generics and that they would be able to charge the state workers' comp the retail price for a brand drug. That sounds like fraud to me. I turned that over to the workers' comp folks and they're pursuing that. I don't know where that went. There was no special reason why this physician got it. I suspect that every orthopedic surgeon, neurosurgeon, and many other folks got that. And my experience has been at Regions, we were constantly fighting companies that would do business out of a motel room, sell supplies, sell this, that. When there's a lot of money, there's a lot of opportunity. The last two bullet points there, just try and give you a sense that the future, I think, is pretty cloudy. There's a lot of skepticism about whether market forces will bring prices down. Risk, the cost of risk, will likely get better unless we have more 9/11. The underwriting cycle will moderate. Commercial premiums will moderate a bit, but the future, I think, is for significant premiums for the foreseeable future. We also continue to have a very wide variation in what services are provided and what they cost across the whole system. Let me just move quickly to the third area I wanted to mention. Yesterday and today, there were some questions that came up that I wanted to just let you know we have information about cost shifts. We have a very detailed and complicated analysis of what the impact will be from a cost shift point of view of the current waiver. We'd be happy to share it with you. It would take much more time than we have today to explain. But the concept is simple. The waiver brings in an additional, I think, $30, $40, $50 million of federal dollars and employer contributions through FIA. When you bring additional dollars into the state's healthcare system as a whole, there should be less cost shift, not more. In the example that was used previously, an individual who is disenrolled because he hasn't paid his premium and goes to the emergency room, individually, his services will lead to a cost shift. However, there will be that $50 million, part of which will make a person essentially taking his place from an eligibility point of view, and that person's cost will decrease the cost shift. That's cost shifting. We do have statistics on the uninsured. Unfortunately, our statistics are driven by a survey, which is a very large one for a state, but becomes unstable when you talk about smaller groups. So we can provide uninsurance data by region. We can't get down to every county. And we can provide data for larger ethnic and minority groups like Hispanic. But it becomes unstable from a numbers point of view. We're actually working on that in 2002 and hope to figure out how to give better data for smaller population groups. The final thing I would just like to do is have you look at a three-page piece that should be in your packet. It looks like this. This is a very well-done study done by the Providence Health System, by a division of the Providence Health System called CORE. It's funded by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, so independent funding, independent source of information. This study was done because of concerns and national concerns that income eligibility causes more of a churning in terms of enrollment. This is happening across the country. This reports on a year of eligibility and enrollment experience in Oregon. 600,000 people. Well, this is a very large study. Its major conclusions were, number one, there isn't that much turbulence in terms of people moving from plan to plan, but there is an enormous amount of turbulence, people moving onto the Oregon Health Plan and then being moved off. If you look by eligibility category, the percentage of people that lose their eligibility range from 30 to 60%. Thousands of people are losing their eligibility every month. They're, you know, reassessed every 6 months. The data I thought would be interesting given yesterday's discussion. If you return the page, it's labeled page 18. It looks like this. They did a telephone survey of 600 people who had lost eligibility and asked, well, why did you lose eligibility? 62% lost eligibility because of their income rose. So someone is out there effectively determining what these people's incomes are and making determinations in which they lose their eligibility. I'd also bring your attention to the next page, which then asks those 62%, what are the reasons that your resources exceeded the limit? 27% of these people got jobs. 22% worked more. 11% got a pay raise and they reported it. The state found out about spousal pay increases. They found out about spouses having a new job. They found out about increased child support. One of the most interesting policy pieces in Oregon is to look at the impact of income eligibility. I know all of you have run into people. I've run into a person who was $8 over, and he was off. Run into people who, wondered about these same incentives. And I would just encourage you to perhaps get the people who did this to come in, because their conclusion was this is a system that while it provides a safety net, it's a very unpredictable one. Large numbers of people are frequently falling through the cracks of this safety net because of issues around income eligibility. Just wanted to bring that to your attention.
But, Doctor, I understand what you're saying, but say the opposite of that is that everybody should have access to health care, notwithstanding the cost. And somebody's $8 off. It's a bright line decision. I mean, you've got to draw a line somewhere.
Mr. Chair, I agree. I think to some degree the waiver creates a sliding scale.
In what way? And,
well, because of the premiums that are charged in the new OHP standard, because of the way FEOP is structured, it gives people an alternative as their incomes rise, but it costs them more. They will have to contribute more, but it gives them an alternative. So actually that was one of the things we were hoping to accomplish with the waiver, to reinforce what we think is already happening. People are trying to rise out of the situation that they're in, and we're helping them do that. We are concerned. We realize one of the reasons why having a six-month uninsurance requirement is so important for OHP standards in FEOP, and consumer advocates do not like that, is because if we don't, there will be less incentives for employers to offer insurance. We have seen in other states that in a pinch, looking at all their options, employers, as was discussed yesterday, will drop insurance and tell people to head over to Medicaid. So you've got to be tough and not let that happen and watch that like a hawk. Because everybody's got to pitch in here. So, in our view, the waiver creates options that we didn't have before to help these folks. And they,
do you have a certified smart person like Paul Warner, or that plugs this into a model and I guess make assumptions about any number of people who, from month to month, might be getting a better job or pay raise that might then have to pay a higher premium, and what that means in terms of total cost?
Well, Mr. Chair, I would assume a lot of certifiable smart people have looked at what we're doing. I know LFO has and John Britton has, and I would assume that Paul has at least some awareness, but I think we'd welcome that. It's a complex picture. You know, the other thing I would want to mention to you all that I scratch my head about is I am worried about hospitals in Coos Bay and Grants Pass, Klamath Falls, because if we step back and we lose match, those hospitals are the largest employers in their towns. And you've been there, I've been there. But those are the employers that are hiring people. I don't know what the economic impact of that is. I don't know what the pros and cons. But Paul and other people really need to look at that. The type A and Bs are fine. They're getting costs. They're getting 100% of what they need. But the legacies in Providence, they'll figure it out. They're smart. Those mid-sized markets, I think, are very vulnerable. Mr. Chair?
Go ahead, Senator.
Thank you. I really hear you asking us to take a look at, to invite the certified smart men who provided this report, the Robert Wood Johnson folks.
I'm hearing you ask us to do that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, absolutely.
Because you said in your preface that this is an objective outside review that could assist us in our further deliberations. It's information that we can put together with the Secretary of State's audit that we already have. As we look down the road at the future of the Oregon Health Plan. So my question, Mr. Chair, would be, can we take time, will we take time to do that, to hear from the Robert Wood Johnson folks who have delivered this timely report to us?
Well, Senator, I appreciate the comment, and I certainly wouldn't mind, depends on the tolerance of the committee in terms of having the ability to sit through those discussions. I think the backdrop for that is, does that apply in a limited resource environment? In other words, and I don't know, again, that's why you suggest a fairly interesting concept to me, and it sounds plausible, but until I see this applied in some simulation of a real-world environment, I don't know whether we can afford it.
I think that we have the opportunity and need to seek as much information as we can get, and particularly information that is objective and information that is free from our political thinking and processes that can help us again in our thoughtful deliberations about where we want to take the Oregon Health Plan. So I hope that we do hear from the Robert Wood Johnson folks, and I hope we hear from them soon.
Mr. Chair, if I could. It's not appreciated as much here in Oregon because we all agree on it. But outside of Oregon, there is no question what the most interesting piece of the waiver will be. For the first time, the federal government is going to give a state the ability to enroll people after fully informing them and let some of them choose between a private insurance-oriented approach like FIAT and a public insurance approach like CHIP and Medicaid. And this is a demonstration. It's designed to see who will choose that. Why will they choose that? How will that work? Which people will feel better about being in FIAP because there's 12 months eligibility and they can go to a doctor with a Blue Cross card? That is a truly original way, and everybody, I think, is interested in that.
Well, again, it sounds plausible. Sounds like a great idea, but who's going to do the data entry? Who's gathering the data at this point to determine whether or not these people are choosing one over the other, or if they're satisfied or not satisfied, or seeing better medical care or not?
Well, Mr. Chair, over the next year, we received a grant from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation to help us prepare the waiver, implement the waiver, and set the framework for evaluating it. In fact, I think we're going to be before an e-board committee when the e-board needs to ask that our limitation be increased so we can move more resources in that grant to the evaluation process because everything has happened faster than usual. We'll be doing that, and there will be an evaluation plan. And I can tell you the state's going to be overrun with health service researchers wanting to study what's happening here and getting money from various foundations because of the cost sharing, because of FIAT, because of a variety of other issues in that waiver. And there's going to be a lot of consumer advocates very concerned about Oregon is being too tough on Medicaid and has asked for too much flexibility. I'm sure it will get done.
Any other questions? Any other comments? No?
quite the thing, though.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yes, we're going to be back.
Have you spoken yet?
What do you want to share? I thought you were all done, and maybe you'd spoken while I was gone. So.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jim Neely, Deputy Assistant Director of the Department of Human Services. And I thought what I would do, and especially given the lateness of the hour, is let you know about a few things that have been added to your binder that hopefully will respond to some of the questions that came up yesterday in regards to the eligibility audit.
Yeah, next in your audit section behind the two audits.
Yeah. And I'll try and be brief here. The first one looks like this, and it's titled Office of Medical Assistance Program. And this is some information that breaks out in terms of the eligibility for the early health plan, where people are in terms of their income scale. It's kind of an interesting breakdown because you'll notice it's divided between families and adults and couples. And you'll note that in terms of no income support, it's about 14.5% of the families, but about 53% of the adults and couples that report no income. And then throughout the rest of the scale, from 1% to 100% of the poverty level, fairly even spreads in terms of one increment to the next. If it would be useful to the committee, I'd be happy to have the workers that do eligibility every day develop half a dozen profiles of these are our half dozen most typical applications that we get that might give you a composite of what these individuals look like. You may have got some of that already. If not, I'd be happy to put that together.
Yeah, actually, I think it would be profitable to have some discussion regarding that. Now, were you going to respond to the audit on the eligibility issues?
Mr. Chair, a good portion of that was responded to yesterday. I'm happy to answer additional questions. I've gotten from the administrator another list of questions that was produced that I'll be happy to either take a shot at or respond in writing, whatever you prefer.
Why don't you respond in writing for the ones that were given to you? But we have not had a presentation on what the agency's actual response has been to the two audits in terms of what policies have been changed or how we're trying to eliminate or minimize errors, questions, social security numbers, et cetera. Have we?
Mr. Chair, I believe yesterday Sue Abrams talked about the eligibility audit
but we haven't had a discussion with respect to what the agency has done in response to the audit. So we have the audit, we know what the audit is, but we don't know what the agency has done in response to the audit.
Mr. Chair, I think you got some of that yesterday, although I wasn't here yesterday. I would be happy to give you a point by point on, I think we've distilled out, since they're kind of sprinkled through the audit, what were the recommendations. I'd be happy to provide to you exactly what we've done on each of those.
Yeah, no, I think part of the question we were looking for was what was the exact response to the audit and the various points raised by the audit, what the timeline would be for implementation of any changes, whatever that might be. We want to kind of know what you guys are.
Okay, and I apologize. I thought you had gotten that yesterday, but I'd be happy to either do that again and do it point by point in writing, some combination.
We're going to be back tomorrow about 1:30. It would be, I think it would be helpful. I'd like to hear what the agency's doing. I mean, the audit in and of itself seems to be rather damning, and then I've not really heard a defense to that for the most part, other than, yeah, we kind of can't agree with it.
I think what you're saying, Mr. Neely, is that we did a little bit touch on it. I remember when I was chairing and you had to step out a moment. There was some of that a little bit yesterday. I think, and I have some questions that I will submit as well. I just one of them real quick, you can probably tell me, can we ever ask for individual tax returns as far as wage and income, or is that something that's not allowed?
Mr. Chair, Senator Carno, I don't know that we would be precluded from asking for tax returns. Certainly, we can do check wait in our records. I'm not sure that the Revenue Department can share those with us. Individuals like that could. I don't know if the Fed would prohibit us from doing that or not.
I wondered if you were prohibited. I know that the individual would have to do that. You couldn't get it from the Revenue Department. I realize that. Just wondered if you were prohibited by state or federal law from asking for that information. And I'll submit the rest of these. I don't want to take up your time now.
I know I can be like a turnip sometimes, you know, a little bit dense. But, yeah, I would like something more specific with respect to what the agency's done in response to the office, anything, what the timeline has been. I work for the Portland Police Bureau, and every time we do something that public doesn't like, we have to generally respond in some way, inviting and sending press conferences. I kind of like to hear what you guys are doing. I mean, in fact, one of the criticisms of this new organization is that there isn't a lot of knowledge or understanding with respect to how you operate. So it's kind of like the, you know, we'll have some sunshine here. We can't just kind of open the doors and see what we can find out. Senator Carroll.
Mr. Chairman, along those lines, I think we forgot to ask a question of Kathy Polano when she was here in our earlier presentation, and that is, what work left is yet to be done? I mean, the folks that did those audits certainly got indicators that there were other questions that could be asked if they had the resources and the time to do it, and we forgot to ask. So at some point in time, I'd like to have Ms. Polano back and just say, you know, you've got a taste of the agency and you look to a certain depth. And there were certainly some indicators on other questions that could reasonably be asked. What would they be? You know, and I think we might get some good direction on what kind of additional audit topics there could be.
I agree. Excuse me, too. I'm somewhat skeptical and cynical of and Senator Troy, you've actually done a remarkable job of keeping a positive attitude over the years.
Now that's a piece of cynicism. If I've ever heard one.
But I mean, I asked a simple question one time in Ways and Means, and it uncovered $800,000 that was just simply being buried in somebody's budget, and everybody seemed to be rather surprised. And the $800,000 was money that was being raffled by the Department of Motor Vehicles, and David Lumine, you may remember, the director, to front load the advanced planning for a new computer system for DMV. The rest of which became history after spending $100 million on a system that did not work. So I'm somewhat skeptical, and I would like some help from the agency in helping us understand more of who you are and what you're about, because I think your mission is noble. I think Senator Farioli indicated his general support, and so even though on a personal note, I politically have no qualms shutting the entire Oregon Health Plan down, it wouldn't bother me at all. It's gone. But that isn't going to happen. And I think there's a lot of other people who have an interest in representing constituent groups that would not like to see that happen. So I think overall, we might see if we can't make the thing work better, be more accountable and more effective. So that when I go back to my constituent group, let's say notwithstanding my bias, but I think we're maybe spending money where I don't think we should, in contrast to public education, where there seems to be a higher priority right now. Really help us help you do a better job. That makes sense. Okay. I don't think you have to be afraid of it. Well, maybe you do.
Mr. Chair, it strikes fear in my heart, even though you couched your statement in the way that you did. You know, hearing that, you know, you could close down the Oregon Health Plan and it wouldn't bother you. And again, I did hear you say the other things after that. What that says to me, it causes me to wonder out loud about our collective compassion as legislators, as Oregonians.
and those of us who enjoy health care can look at all of this through a certain lens. But if you have ever been poor and without the ability to ensure that your child's teeth are taken care of, get glasses for school, proper immunization, you have a medical emergency and you need help. If you've not ever been in that circumstance, I don't know that hearing about a composite group of folks can help us really understand it. And again, when those kinds of statements are uttered, again, it just gives me pause, and it makes me question what else we're going to do with this issue and with what has been created and what we now know as the Oregon Health Plan that serves a whole lot of poor people in our state, and we have a growing number of poor people. I don't want to sit here and lecture, but you know, we lead in hunger, we lead in unemployment. We're known to the nation for that, and now to the world, and then here we are doing whatever it is we're going to do with the health plan. And I'm not I don't want to question anybody's motivation. That's not what my statement is about. Again, your statement uttered causes me to respond in this way.
And Senator, let me respond to you. I can assure you that I was raised poor, but my family, my father, was a migrant farm worker before migrant farm workers became popular. My family has a long history of being poor, let me assure you, and I've been there.
Mm-hmm.
But I am also pragmatic, and the state of Oregon is expending an extraordinary amount of money on these issues. And we have competing issues. We have education. We have the health plan. We have correction. And I will not, as a politician, ever misrepresent the truth about what I'm capable of doing with their money and their resources. Because the people of the state of Oregon ultimately decide how much money they will tolerate us spending on our compassion.
Mr. Chairman?
Doctor.
I think I would just add, as you know, a lot of my physician colleagues think of me as an insurance guy. I don't envy your task. But from a pragmatic point of view, there's all these actuaries out there in the health insurance industry in Oregon wondering, how predictable is this going to be? How many dollars are going to be coming in? And how are we going to make sure that we get what we need, whether it's Regents, Providence, Kaiser? And they're watching your decision. And it's stability, from a pragmatic point of view, for me, I think the challenge is stability, predictability, to get those actuaries, those bond folks to calm down. Until we do that, economically, we're all in a lot more risky situation. And that's a big piece of the Oregon Health Plan, given $3.5 billion next to biennium. I don't envy your task, but you are like a board that the market's watching every move, and when you make a decision, that ripples out.
Thanks, Senator Cummins. I appreciate it. Senator George.
Mr. Chairman, just since we're kind of waxing philosophical here, those of us who remember the 40s, the 50s, and the 60s, when you might take to your doctor some eggs or your chicken, and all of our kids got immunized because we weren't rich, and we had, some very, very poor friends and family. You look at the system today, and those of us who participated in the debate back at 1990 levels, and remembered that the guarantees were that this program was never going to cost more than $40 million. And we look at the audit and we hear $2,500 million, and we hear $500 million more dollars. I think it's very, very reasonable to start questioning where we're going. You know, it kind of reminds me of the PERS. Great thing. A person ought to provide, you know, retirement for employees. That's a great thing to do. But right here, it's the same situation. This is so out of control. We're talking 8 years, and now we're talking about adding $500 million to $2.5 billion when we promised people it would never cost more than $40 or $50 million. So hopefully this is a very good exercise.
Yeah, Senator Perriola.
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the discussion that we're engaged in. I think this is exactly the kind of discussion we need to have. The fact of the matter is, I just heard the doctor say that we should be very concerned about the cost of overreaching. You know, and I think the good senator from Portland is right to remind us of the compassionate motives behind the Oregon Health Plan. Absolutely. And I mentioned yesterday, 40% of the folks in District 30 are Department of Human Resources clients or are eligible. And those are critical services. Those are poor people. But the definition of compassion has to have a component of discipline and predictability. And that's exactly what Dr. Stamkos just said. If we are undisciplined, if we're a little more compassionate than we can afford to be, and this system collapses, it will retrench back to the federal system and it will cut off benefits for half of the people that are currently being served. And I see the real danger of letting our compassion blind us to the reality that we've lost $22.5 billion out of the private sector in earnings and wages. And that right now our biggest export product is jobs, and the growing state product is unemployment. And if we're not aware of those things and we're not cognizant of the cost of these things and the drivers and aren't willing to look very hard inside this agency to control those drivers, we're going to push the system to system collapse. And the feds are going to say, well, you know, it was a nice experiment. You know, you're number one. And your waiver's canceled. And that's a real possibility if we are able to balance the compassion that we need to have for people who constantly battle and the resources that are within the system already but are not being wisely used. I hope nobody's under any misimpression. Pricewaterhouse says it's 5%. Fraud investigators say 10 is more average. We need the agency to take a real hard look at itself about the cost of bureaucracy and the cost of waste and fraud and what we do to make the organization more efficient. And that has not been the hallmark of the agency. You know, that's a better definition of compassion to me than just to say, well, we're going to dump more money into this thing until the point at which, as our chairman has said, Oregon voters say, can't afford it. Can't afford it. And that's a real possibility that I personally would hate to have to face because of the number of people in the district that I represent that depend on this program. So we're going to do the hard work, and we're going to do it honestly. And if we don't do it, if we fail to do that in this committee, then this will fail. So, you know, the definition of compassion without discipline won't work.
Senator Fisher,
I agree with Senator Ferraioli and Dr. Senna. I would say this, that the very people that are looking at us as a board are also going to be looking at how we monitor the programs we're running. And just dumping money into it isn't going to gain their favor. They're going to also want to know that stuff is doing what it's supposed to be doing. And that concerns me greatly. And I believe I would perhaps gently correct Senator George, since I was here when this program was initiated, that about the $40 million was what it was supposed to be the first biennium that it was instigated, but it was only going to run about 6 months of that biennium. So it was more of the 200 to 300 million that it was projected to grow to, and many of us at that time said 500 million. Well, we were not very far down the line before we were right. And I stated time again, I don't think there's a country in the world that can give everybody every bit of health care that they could desire, run through, and maintain any kind of hold on economic reasonability. And I will say that again. And so I, too, like Senator Crayola, feel that we've got to make these dollars count. We've got to make them get out and do the job that they need to do. And that we also have to monitor them in the process and not just add to them blindly. So, I'm very interested in doing this. It's been tough in the meantime to try to get a handle on any of these things. And that's something, if I have a criticism about present administration, is we've had a lot of things that are going right down the drain here with our state hospital and some things like that, that it's burning money and utilizing money and funds in a way that they would absolutely blister the private or nonprofit sector if they were even approaching doing that kind of thing. And we've had absolutely no help at all in staunching some of the flow of money into those arenas from the present administration. And frankly, it's got to stop.
Chairman, just to clarify just real quickly, and it's probably my fault by using the $2.5 billion. The discussion that occurred back then was talking about the state contribution,
right.
And we were talking about 40, and the person that made the statement that it would never, in this debate, exceed $75 million state contribution, but according to the audit report, we're now at our share of $1 billion. I think that's the number that we're all looking at here. So sorry about that, Bill, because I should have clarified the state's amount that was going to be going into the program.
Well, we do know that this is an extensive program. It's a very valuable program that lots of people really depend upon. And I think we're going to have a debate this election time over a far more extensive program that some people want that would cost a great deal more than the present program that we have. And I think the fact that that's there on the ballot, that it's got the signatures that it needs, and so forth, does show you that there's a tremendous interest in this issue. And some people want a much more comprehensive program than we now have. So I obviously we're obligated for whatever program we have to make it as efficient as possible to get as much bang for the buck as we can in terms of delivering good services to people. And we want the program to do that. But I just have to reaffirm the compassion I think we need to feel for the people of Oregon. This program is cost-effective if you think about what it does for the people of this state on a whole. It's cost-effective because it helps people be healthier and they can lead better lives and they can be more productive. And I don't think there's any doubt about it. So I think we got to keep it in perspective.
Right. I think they're all good comments. In fact, that Senator Gordon, me well enough to know that something like that should also be my idea. And I full disclosure, but I don't disclose the entire money. Thoughts often sometimes I should be able to express that. But I think it is important to note that we're, as a nation, involved in a much broader discussion about healthcare and economic policy. And so there are a lot of ideas floating out there about how you would deal with health insurance and health care, and what the physicians think about how they should be treating patients, whether it's with protein, trying to find food that's better for you than bad food that's better for you, all that kind of stuff. I don't understand. But we as a state, I think, if I can correct me if I'm wrong, this experiment has been kind of leading the experiment on healthcare and the administration of public resources for healthcare purposes. Is that right at all? I don't know what feds are looking at Oregon and saying that you're really a national leader or you're not a national leader, or gee, we hope you produce something good. Here's your waiver, hope the state of the healthcare in Antioch seems to be something in the air. Maybe a little later, maybe not, I don't know.
Well, Mr. Chair, as I travel out of the state and sit down with other states, I think there's no state that has been willing to take on more tough choices. We have a HRSA grant. There's 20 states that have HRSA grants. There's only a few of them that have been successful putting a waiver together. When I present our waiver idea to those 20 states, the Vermonts, the Massachusetts, the Wisconsins, basically shake their head and say, we could never take 20% of benefits away from 100,000 people. We could never do that trade-off. We're taking 20% of benefits away from 100,000 people to cover 50,000 more. There's nobody in the room, except people from Utah. So they did the same thing. Having the guts to make those kinds of trade-offs is what has been unusual about this state the last 20 years.
All right. So actually, I do think that the work of the committee could be that. And I'll ask the individual members to talk to me from time to time, let me know what you think the appropriate direction should be. I have some of my own ideas.
Mr. Chair, ballot measure 23 passes. What is the plan?
Yeah, we won't have to be worried about any other elements in the budget.
I think we don't have to worry about that.
Go back to the old
lady. 1:30 tomorrow. We're adjourned.